Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd take your seats, please. Delta Stewardship Council is called to order, starting with Mr. Nordhoff. Let's establish a quorum. Mr. Nordhoff.
Fiorini here.
Eisenberg here. Okay, we know that Ms. Marcus's train was 15 minutes late. She sent us an email. She'll be here shortly. Mr. Johnston will be here shortly. And last I heard, is Ms. Gray here? Yeah, she'll be here shortly too. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had a bunch of people cancel out on us for various reasons today, so the agenda is going to be somewhat shortened, I think. There's Ms. Gray. Thank you very much, Ms. Gray. Let's start off with the, well, we got the roll call. Let me just give a brief report. I must leave at noon. I apologize. I have a memorial service to go to. I cannot avoid. Randy's going to chair from that point on. And I appreciate your consideration. The other thing is, if you haven't been reading, Mr. Machado, I read about you in the Manteca Bulletin. You are irreplaceable, according to that newspaper. Is that? It is that, Mike Machado. Yes, thank you. Nice. It was a nice editorial there, Mike. There was a recent dust-up, one of the periodic dust-ups at the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. If you haven't read the newspapers, I would recommend you take a look at the note. This is the one where the extension and funding of the second stage of the contract also involved some agreements between the governmental officials and the contractors on reports and submissions and releases and so on. And the media is full of all kinds of delicious stuff, yelling, screaming, and hollering. And if it wasn't that, it'd be something else, no doubt. But it's worth keeping up with. So that is my report. Mr. Grindstaff, you have a series of items. Meeting will reflect. Ms. Marcus is here.
And I note that staff has shifted seating here. It's going to confuse everybody. Okay.
If you sit next to him, you're consigned to an eight-hour meeting every 3 days.
Probably first thing I want to let everyone know that the EIR will be released next Friday, the 4th. We approved spending money in all the newspapers where they have to advertise it, so the EIR on the Delta Plan will be released next Friday. We're planning on doing a 60-day comment period, and
law requires how long?
Well, the law says a minimum of 45 days, okay, and recommends that it not go over 60 days. And I know that some people want it to be longer. So later on, when we talk about the EIR, we can have that discussion.
Yeah, that'll be item 9 on the agenda.
That'll be and I want to compliment everybody. It's been a real struggle to get the EIR done. But the consultants, the attorneys, the Attorney General's office have done yeoman's work in trying to get a document that actually adheres to the law and tries to help us achieve the co-equal goals. And I want to take the opportunity to say thank you. They have worked, I think it's been 8 weekends in a row that people have worked through the weekend, including Chris Stevens here, our counsel, and many of the staff and consultants in order to get it done. It's a difficult process. We haven't done anything quite like this in the state before. And while it's frustrating, I'm proud of the effort that they put in to that.
Mr. Stevens is 22 years old, but he looks slightly older. Is it this process which ages him?
Indeed. Thank you for that recognition and compliment.
The second thing I'd like to bring up, we have Mike Machado here today, and we should probably ask him to report. We have been informed that the Delta Protection Commission, and the chair obviously is on the council here, approved the Economic Sustainability Plan with some reservations based on the peer review, which is going to be happening next week. I believe the panel comes together and their report should be done very quickly. But I probably ought to let Mike and Don Natoli talk about that.
Okay. Mr. Machado. Mike, could you hit that button? It's in the center.
Right.
See where my no, on the stand. Yeah, right there. There you are.
They keep changing these. Thank you, Chair Eisenberg. I'd really like to turn it over to Chair Natoli of the Delta Protection Commission to report what happened at the commission meeting and the subsequent report that Brunel brought copies for all of you.
Okay.
Okay, I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, and Mike certainly can fill in the gaps. I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow of the meeting on Tuesday evening, but like Joe Greinstaff just said a moment ago, certainly with the council's consultants and staff, folks with the commission, Mr. Machado and his staff, but certainly the consultant team, worked very, very hard. I think I would be surprised if they didn't work weekends as well to meet the deadlines to bring forward the various drafts of the Economic Sustainability Plan. I want to also extend a thanks to this council and certainly to Joe and his staff because it was better part of a year, almost a year and a half ago now, that money was allocated early on so we could begin the effort, which included many meetings, certainly a good deal of research, and the plan that's going to be distributed here this morning reflects, again, not only the consultant work, a good deal of public input, many of the folks here in this audience and many who followed it very closely have commented just as they do on the various drafts of the Delta plan. But I think what you'll find before you is a plan that reflects the importance of many of the activities as it relates to the economic, just as the plan says, economic sustainability of the Delta. And it takes a snapshot of current activities, but also then projects some of the impacts of not only what may happen as this plan is developed by the council of applying the co-equal goals, but it really does focus in on the importance of agriculture and its sustainability, the necessity not only to have support services, but certainly the land mass that's important to that, talks about the value of the crops. It also focuses in on the importance of recreation and tourism, and I think puts a proper perspective on what contributions are made by that particular pursuit in the Delta and its importance, and also focuses on the infrastructure, and looks closely at that infrastructure that not only supports the region, but the entire state. And I think the report is well done. We've spent a lot of time, as I said, last two evenings ago, going down through the recommendations. It talks to those things that are important for the long-term viability and sustainability of agriculture, certainly of economics that make the Delta function and work, and I think reflects a good body of work. So with that, I'm going to turn to Mike and let him maybe highlight a little more some of the other aspects. And again, I want to certainly compliment Mike for his work and leadership and that of, and certainly the council has been very, very good council staff in communicating back and forth as we've tried to deliver this as close to on time as we can get it.
Thank you.
Mr. Machado.
I think the report is going to highlight, I think, the conflicts the council has come up to against in terms of what the legislation is requiring. And how to achieve the co-equal goals consistent with the policy objectives attached to it in terms of preserving and enhancing agriculture, et cetera. One of the things that comes out of the report probably, which was an eye-opener for not only the researchers but the commission members, was the role that infrastructure plays as a driver in the economy of the Delta. The researchers came up to a point where just the infrastructure that's both important for in-state as well as intrastate has about the same economic value as that as the water system to California. And the document, as you know, is scheduled for peer review. The first meeting is next Tuesday, and that's going to be held.
Two
meetings.
Yeah.
The presentation of the report will take place Tuesday at Wright Hotel, and then there will be a subsequent meeting on Wednesday in Sacramento, the Pagoda Building, for the first reporting out of the peer review panel. I want to compliment the staff of the Stewardship Council in helping us put together the peer review team. I think the the charge questions, and the composition of the team is reflective of the collaboration between both the researchers for the Economic Sustainability Plan as well as the science team within the council. We basically have gone through it at a prior meeting. The recommendations have been refined some. As you know, there is a local government component within the commission that did express themselves. But I think this document would hopefully provide a perspective that can help the council in developing the plan to recognize and try to address the many concerns of local government in the Delta and the requirements that they have to meet local services, and also recognize the conflict that's there in terms of trying to pursue what the charge of economic sustainability with the multiple layers of regulations that exist that tend to cloud or create uncertainty for the type of private investment that would be necessary for that. And I think that's a conflict that both the council and the commission has recognized as we've wrestled through the various the plan as well as this document that you have before you.
Mr. Chair, I just would add just briefly to that, draw your attention to the cover letter, which again is certainly not intended to be the executive summary by any means, but it does go through, and I think just as Mike highlighted, it talks to things that this council has spent a good deal of time talking about in the context of the Development Delta Plan, but it talks to the importance certainly of levees and the investment in levees, the importance of not only water quality but water reliability for the Delta and its long-term economic sustainability, legacy communities and their survival. It looks at the regulatory regime and has a good deal of focus on continued layers of regulation and permitting and so forth that make it extremely difficult in a lot of cases to encourage additional private investment to complement obviously the public investment that's there in the levy system and certainly in the other infrastructure. And it goes on certainly to talk about something that we've spent a lot of time talking about here, covered actions and some concerns as to how those may be applied over time and what they may do to certainly to the viability and sustainability of pursuits, agriculture in particular, but other pursuits in the Delta as well. So, again, it'll be a good deal of reading, as you know, this couple hundred pages plus, but I think there's a lot in here that can help inform the Delta Plan, and we would, I guess the last point I would make that the request there, and again, this is up for the council's consideration, is that the commission, in transmitting this, once the peer review is completed, has requested, and that's the conclusion of the letter, that presenting this, we ask that it be included in the context of the Delta Plan. And that's
just a question. I know that there were some changes made at the Protection Commission meeting a couple of days ago. Are they now reflected in the plan?
Yeah, the changes were made with respect to the recommendations, and they were essentially wordsmithing.
Okay.
And then the other substantial change.
And those are reflected in the plan.
There's no red line in that. If there is a red line version available, if the council would like that. And
well, only because I want to make sure that we have the official document that you submitted to us and a letter that just says the following wordsmithing changes are anticipated would be terrific just to have around. We know you've reserved the right after the peer review panel to make whatever changes you deem appropriate.
That's no problem. We can forward that.
I think this version incorporates all of the changes they made. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
This includes the actions we took the other other evening,
all
Phil.
Right.
Now,
okay.
There are things that come out of the peer review, that would be a version.
And I believe the addendums, the changes are also being forwarded for consideration by the peer review panel.
Okay. Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, just a point of clarification then or a question. You know, our statute talks about us receiving officially a copy of the Economic Sustainability Plan. It actually has time deadlines for our review as to consistency with the Delta Plan. Obviously, that language also contemplates additional subsequent updates once the Delta Plan's in effect. But is the idea here that that our review wouldn't really officially take place until after the peer review, or that's part of it, or have you guys thought about how
Good question. I'll turn the mic
well,
on
I think, I think part of the challenge is going to be with the development of the Delta Plan and incorporation in that. And our goal from talking with council staff was to try to get a final report as soon as possible to you for consideration. But we have this overlap because of the peer review. We would like to have it done in 2 weeks, and the peer review panel has suggested it would probably take more than a month. So I think we're flexible, but I would think that this document here is essentially the final document subject to any major items that might be drawn to the attention by the peer review panel.
So, and again, maybe just to add to that, I think the intent, obviously, is to have this considered for inclusion in this version of Delta Plan rather than something that would follow on or, you know, be some process that would be subsequent to the current development of the Delta Plan. So, again, I don't know about the statutory deadlines, Chris, but...
Well, it's not exactly clear, but the statutory deadline says that the commission shall transmit copies of the Economic Sustainability Plan and any subsequent amendment to us and to local governments and agencies within 60 days of adoption. And presumptively, that's sufficient time to allow changes after the peer review. Now, if it didn't, we'd have a legal question, but I think that's probably handled. And then it says, within 180 days of the Commission's adoption or amendment, the Stewardship Council shall review the Economic Sustainability Plan for consistency with the Delta Plan. That's probably the most unclear language because, of course, we have a fifth draft Delta Plan, but we don't have the final adopted Delta Plan and will not until, in the new schedule, March of next year. But let the lawyers think about that without us prejudging the issue. I mean, the fact is we've got something to look at, to work with. You folks have got the right to review and change after the peer review stuff, which is fine. We'll work it out somehow. Yeah.
And I think we'd be grateful for that flexibility.
Okay. Randy.
Don, Mike, congratulations. In our assembly line-like process here at the Delta Stewardship Council, it's nice to receive another box of parts that will hopefully be useful in building this plan that we're all working so hard on. And I look forward to reading it. I just perused the bibliography, and I didn't see the report that Dr. Sumner did and at the on behalf of the Department of Agriculture, or the Department of the State Department of Agriculture, was that did I miss it, or
it's
is it not
referred
in the...
to in the it's referenced into the body? I'm whether or not it's specifically in the bibliography, I'm not sure, but it has been referenced in the body, and I think it's also referenced in the executive summary.
I suspect there'll be certain wordsmithing going on for some time, as with our document and with this one.
Yes, and there is another. There is another supporting document of appendices, if you would like that too. That's
right.
Probably of equal or greater length than that.
Okay. I more parts. Yeah, I think the analogy that Randy uses is a good one, and we're hopeful and optimistic that these parts will fit well into the machine and will. Help, I think, make for a finer-tuned plan that this council is considering.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Natoli. Okay, Joe.
I'm not sure that Kurt wants to really update us on the legislature because they're out of session right now, but I think I'll let Chris talk about a legal update if he has anything to say. Oh, you do.
Oh, he's actually got something to say here. All right.
Okay.
There's secret information to reveal. Use that microphone there, Ms. Miller.
I want my 2 minutes of fame.
This is the wrong place for that.
Just two things. point taken. Just 2 points quickly. I know you have a lot to do. Your binders have the ledge update for the last time this year. This is the final set. Based on adjournment actions and governor's signatures and vetoes as of last month. We'll start again in January with updates, but this is the last one you'll receive for your packets. On the second point, I think an update on general fund revenues. The September report from the controller showed about a $700 million slippage behind estimates that were included in the 11-12 Budget Act. That's for 3 months, July, August, and September. You recall, well, actually, we don't recall because I didn't mention it last time, but by December 15th, finance will determine the general fund estimate and compare it with the LAO's November estimate. The higher the two will be used to judge against an $87.5 billion benchmark for the general fund. If it's less than that, then the Department of Finance is authorized to make reductions amounting to about $400 million. If it slips another below the billion-dollar mark to go higher than a billion deficit, then another $320 million are scheduled for reductions. And as the controller figures come in for October, November, that'll set the stage for what and if finance needs to do anything in December. So,
and that will, the finance decision would obviously be part of the governor's budget in January or premise.
No, this is pre budget activity and must be done and determined by the 15th. And this is current year
December
activity.
15th.
December 15th, right? Current year activity. And presumably, the governor would build a budget or amend his budget in the spring to reflect baseline reductions that are taken under the current year activity and law. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. This sounds very much like the federal budget with their automatic triggered reductions pending, similar but not identical. Okay. Mr. Grindstaff.
I'll turn it over to Chris Stevens for a minute.
In the interest of time, I really don't have anything of substance to report on litigation.
Let me write that down.
Yeah, well, you know the real story. Our legal extern has a class today, so he couldn't come. And I told him the point of his working for us was not to corrupt his education, but to enhance it. So I said, go to class. We'll report on anything of substance at our next meeting.
Yeah. One suggestion, Chris, for this next meeting or the one following, you might want to ask our intern to do a kind of a summary of what you think are significant legal cases that are out there pending, not just, you know, not just the ones we've been following most closely, the salmon and smelt case, but I thought the Wanger decision on the federal contracts and the complaint by Northern California agencies that they're entitled to take their water first was interesting. It's different from the state water project argument, but it's worth noting. And there's some other cases out there that are very intriguing and worth knowing about.
I'll do that. And as you know, in the 4 or 5 years that we've worked together, we've reported on a whole variety of cases, many of which are now on appeal, important ones
right.
that you mentioned, and we'll put together a list for you.
Okay, Mr. Grindstaff.
I just want to note that we have attached our contract update as we do every quarter.
Oh, that's right. Members, 4B in the agenda is the, I think it's a quarterly.
Quarterly.
Yes. Summary of activities on outstanding contracts. And I think some of them go back to 2006 and have been going on multi-years. So you've seen, I think you've seen all of these before.
I think there were 4 or 5 new contracts in there, but I think actually most of them had been to the council. So, for example, contracted on support for the administrative rulemaking process was part of the extension we brought to the council here 2 months ago.
Last month or the month before.
Yeah. So I think most of them have all been to the council before, but I just want to point out we continue to do this on a routine basis. If you have any questions, either publicly or privately, I'd be glad to answer them.
Okay. All right. Any questions on this, members? Anyone in the audience like to talk about the contracts? Okay. All right. Mr. Grindstaff, anything else?
Nothing else.
Okay. Members, let's go, please, to file item 5, which is the minutes of the meeting of September. Are there comments, questions, corrections, edits? Comments, questions, corrections, edits? Randy.
Move approval.
Is there a second? Second, Ms. Gray. Anyone in the audience like to talk about the minutes? Occasionally we get people who want to have a more detailed summary of what they said, or less detailed, depending. Okay, seeing no one wishing to comment, starting with Mr. Nordhoff, we'll call the roll.
Aye.
Nordhoff, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Marcus, abstain.
Natoli, aye.
Okay, it adopted 5-0 with one abstention and one absent. Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to number six, if we could please, members. File item number six, the lead scientist report. Ms. Hastings, Dr. Mueller-Solger, good to see you. You folks have a lot going on. What's up?
Yes, we do have a lot going on. And I just wanted to start with letting you know what Cliff has going on, mm-hmm. And why he's not here today. He is has been in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho this week at a meeting called EPSCoR, which is the Experimental Program to Stimulate Competitive Research. It's sponsored by the National Science Foundation, and Cliff frequently refers to this as the NSF program for the dumb states. So I think I can say that because he says it. But it's basically, California's not part of that effort. It's a way to get funding into the smaller states. So right. He's been busy there, and he's been there with our lead scientist candidate, Peter Goodwin, who is actually has been responsible for organizing that meeting. Hmm. So I've got three things to talk about, and then Anka's going to talk about a fourth thing. Just wanted to briefly mention a recent conference that we had in Oakland, the 2011 State of the Estuary Conference, and our chair, Phil Eisenberg, was there and part of the plenary session. It was, I thought, a very interesting and worthwhile conference, and enjoyed the session that Phil was part of, where it was a panel discussion. Phil talked about the co-equal goals. Other presenters, Jerry Merrill, talked about BDCP. Fran Spivey-Weber talked about the state board and the flow criteria. So we got to hear her perspective
I thought I talked about how I like to make scientists nervous. Didn't I say that?
I think you mentioned that at every conference.
Yeah, sorry.
I've heard that. Yeah. There were also a couple of Delta focus sessions, and Mike Machado was there. Campbell Ingram, chair of the Conservancy, was there. So that was nice to have those Delta sessions.
And my recollection is there were 800 or 900 people around, mm-hmm. registered for the conference. They alternate, was it every other year, goes to Bay focus, then it alternates the next cycle to a Delta focus, but it's the same collective array of scientists or isn't it?
A little bit. I'll
Y'all look
clarify
the same.
A little. We do look the same, and we attend both. But the you're right. We alternate. So this year was the State of the Estuary Conference, which is always held in the Bay Area, usually in the East Bay, and it's a smaller conference than the one that we sponsor, which is the Bay Delta Science Conference, which we're already starting to work on for next fall. I don't have the dates memorized, but we actually have the dates set for that in September. But the differences are the Bay Conference is really focused around, I'll hold up this document, State of the San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, they issue one every 2 years.
Every
right?
2 years. Yeah. So, and that's why the conference is called State of the Estuary, because it's really focused around this document where they do an evaluation that we're hoping to get to this level as well for the Delta with various indicators of Bay health. So it's a very Bay-focused conference. We've been successful in pushing them to have a little more of a Delta focus in the last several years, and they've been open to that. Their conference is also, at least from our perspective, a little more policy-focused. Our science conference that the Delta Science Program sponsors every other year is really very much a science conference. It's much bigger, many more concurrent sessions. But it's a good match, I think, of having these two conferences. Essentially, every year we get a good conference on these topics. The next item I wanted to talk about is we are very busy right now, the Delta Science Program, with peer review panels 3 weeks in a row. So This week's peer review panel that occurred yesterday and the day before was on the BDCP effects analysis, and which I hope you're all interested in.
Well, we all got the notice, I know, but tell us a little bit more about it because I think it is significant.
Yeah, so we were asked a long time ago to do this review, and we're finally doing it. It's a two-part review. What the panel reviewed this week is what's called the Conceptual Foundation and Analytical Framework, basically the methods document by which the consulting firm ICF will be developing the effects analysis. The effects analysis is basically, as best as possible, using the current tools that we have, what are the effects anticipated to be, positive and negative, of the 19 conservation measures that have been outlined in the current BDCP. So that's what the consultants are expected to do. What our panel has been asked to do is take a look at the approach that they're taking in developing this analysis, and that's part one of the review. Part two will be in March, April, we think. Look at what they did, and how well did they do it from a scientific basis. So doing an effects analysis means using a lot of these models that we talk about all the time, conceptual models as well as analytical models, trying to look at connecting hydrology to what the species or how the species are going to respond. So it's really a very challenging task for the consultants. Our panel was given this basically the methods paper and also an example of how it will be applied in the first appendix. There's, I think, 8 or 9 appendices, and the first appendix was on entrainment. So our panel also reviewed that appendix yesterday, and I can tell you a little bit about what they found if you want to hear it. But
maybe you could also give us a note about the process you used to pick the members of the panel.
Yep. The process that we use for all of our review panels is that we work with a team of the folks that are being reviewed and other interested parties. For example, interested parties here are all the agencies that are involved. And we work with them to develop both the charge of the panel and the membership. But the membership really is left up to the lead scientist. And what Cliff has done and our other lead scientists have done is try to pair. We want an independent panel. And we try to draw on the expertise from outside our system, because a lot of folks have worked in other systems, and that's quite helpful. So we try to partner experts from across the country and even from other countries with some folks that have local knowledge and expertise, but who have not participated in the effort that's being reviewed. This particular BDCP effects analysis panel is quite large. It includes 7 members, because this is a big effort. It spans from aquatic to terrestrial, so we had to span that range of expertise that's needed.
I know you have provisions on conflict of interest and avoiding conflict.
Yep.
Just a brief note on that in general on panels.
We're very conscious and careful about conflict of interest, and the staff do the best we can to screen folks out and also rely on them to self-disclose and generally, that's not been a problem. We don't have.
But that process and your consciousness of it will lead to commonly bring people in from out of state.
Yes.
Who are less likely to have
that's
employment
right.
or contract relationships mm-hmm. with some of the interested parties.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So that's this week's review.
Is the panel going to issue its comments on the first 2-day meeting before April and then?
Yes.
Okay, so
the panel report is due in 1 month, so it's November 25th is the due date for that. That report will be posted on our website publicly, but the intent is that the consultants and agencies, especially the consultants, then respond to the recommendations and conclusions in that report and improve their approach. So that's the expectation. We did have a public reporting out from the panel yesterday just so they could to give them a head start to get going on that now. The schedule for BDCP is very aggressive. So they actually are already working on the several of the appendices right now, and it's kind of a simultaneous effort to improve their process based on these comments while actually producing the appendices. So, we'll report on that when it comes out, and then we'll let you know about the next review, which, again, will be in the spring. Next week's review you already talked about with Mike Machado, which is the review of the Delta Protection Commission Economic Sustainability Plan. And as Mike pointed out, that will be in the Delta at the Ride Hotel on Tuesday next week for the bulk of the panel meeting. They then meet privately that afternoon and the following morning, and they'll report out on their initial comments Wednesday afternoon here in Sacramento. So I think you kind of covered that, but if you have any more questions on that,
I'll... And there's a second follow-up meeting whenever it is.
It's actually a two-day meeting.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, after they report out publicly, the panel then develops their report. That report is due December 2nd, and we have asked the chair of that panel, Bob Gilbert, to come back and present at the December council meeting, December 15th. The committee there consists of two engineers who were both peer reviewers on the DREAM study, Delta Risk Management Strategy, Phase 1 document, and then three economists is the makeup of that panel.
Okay.
The panel the week after next that are sponsoring is a panel that meets annually. This is the second time they've met to review the operations criteria and plan biological opinions, both the salmon opinion and smelt opinion. They don't review the opinions themselves. They review how well the reasonable and prudent alternatives identified have been implemented what lessons have been learned through implementation of those biological opinions. This is the second year that panel has met, and we strive for the same membership on the panel. This year I think have only half of them coming back, but the intent is that we will be reviewing that every year.
And the report would be issued when, do you think?
That report would be issued following our process, I would guess, December 9th. So
okay. let me interrupt you. The
sure.
City of West Sacramento is sponsoring some kind of senior citizens conference here, which will begin shortly. They asked me to caution those who parked in the lot, in spite of all the signs that tell you to park somewhere else, that they would really appreciate it if you move so senior citizens could use it. They have not threatened to tow your car, but they have not promised not to tow your car. So I have read that note, and those of you who are offending parties are on notice for the consequences. Ms. Hastings.
Okay. The final thing I'm going to talk about and then hand it over to Anka is just alerting to you, as Cliff has set this precedent of alerting you to recent scientific papers that have been published. And so, and we've got the link in the report, but this paper that's out is from a project that we funded. The Delta Science Program funded this project called Cascade, which is basically looking at all these models and putting them together, looking at climate change on the global scale, downscaling it to California, how that's going to affect climate in the future, how that will translate to what happens in the rivers, moving all the way down to the Delta, affecting food web, fish, everything else. So they've gotten their first paper out on this, and in their paper they've identified several indicators. So again, we're trying to there's different approaches to developing indicators and performance measures, and we're trying to alert you to that because we'll be using this information as guidance for improving the performance measures in the Delta plan. So this is one of our premier research groups. We've funded them to take this to the next level where they're really going to focus more on outcomes in terms of biological outcomes and even including possible infrastructure changes, which they did not include in their first iteration.
Mm. Okay. Before you start, Dr. Mueller-Soger, any questions for Dr. Hastings? I have one question.
Sure.
I know that 5-6 months ago, we had various requests to create expert panels to review projects relating to BDCP. We turned it down because of the fact we had the hiring freeze, and you know we're essentially down 40% in staff in science. Now the freeze has been lifted. I understand
yes.
that doesn't automatically mean there are 25 people walking in the door, but I think providing the expert panels is one of the hallmarks of the science program, and we ought to try to encourage it for all legitimate requests. Is there going to be, do you have some hope that we can proceed on getting some of those vacancies filled in the science program so we could do these kinds
yes.
of panels?
Yes, thank you. I meant to bring that up, so I'm glad you reminded me. We have 4 vacancies mm-hmm. in the science program right now. And I am happy to report that 2 of those will be filled shortly. We've gotten 2 acceptances of offers, and we've got 2 more that we're working very hard to fill as fast as we can. So I hope at the next meeting I can report that we filled all 4. But yes, we had to say no to several requests. And yesterday, after we heard that the good news that we had some acceptances, we actually went back to that list and said, oh, you know, we can start saying yes to some of these requests now. So, they're all important requests. So.
Yeah, and they're all science-based requests
yes.
to fit within our jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Then plan next month and give us at least a verbal report on how we're doing
okay.
on replacing our lost scientist.
Great.
Dr. Mueller-Solger.
All right. That actually gave me 2 segues here, but I'll start with this one. So this paper here has indicators in it that are about climate, about hydrology, and about habitat.
This is the same one.
This is the same one that Lauren
just
talked
about,
which
yep.
is this Cascade paper co-authored by Jim Clarin and many other folks. And of course, another important indicator that we look at a lot are simply fishes and how they're doing in the system. And the delta fishes are being monitored long-term through the IEP by the Department of Fish and Game, the California Department of Fish and Game, and also by the Fish and Wildlife Service out of their Stockton office. And I will today talk about the Fish and Game's fall indices that are now coming in as we are in the fall, since they are being looked at a lot. But since Lauren just provided the segue, or you did, I'd also like to acknowledge that the Department of Fish and Game is doing this with absolutely minimum staff. They've lost staff. They haven't been able to replace it. In case
right.
any of you are wondering why their data doesn't appear on the internet quite as fast as you might hope, they lost their webmaster. And it just sort of goes on and on. And they're doing heroic things, truly. Heroic things in order to keep this up and not interrupt this important long-term data set, which is truly the pulse of the ecosystem part of this system. So I sure hope this will change, but I understand right now they fear they'll lose more staff than they'll be able to hire anytime soon. I recognize the Department of Fish and Game, and you have in your agenda item 6 attachment the September memo that was written by Randy Baxter of the Fish and Game about the September fall midwater trawl index results for several fish species, including Delta smelt.
That's agenda item 6, attachment 2.
Correct.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And I described this a little bit in this little blurb that is in our staff report as well for Delta smelt, and also talked a little bit about what the X2 has been doing this fall, which is this magical number about where the salt water meets the fresh water, basically, at 2 parts per thousand in kilometers from the Golden Gate. An interesting target for water management and fish management in the system. But let me first talk about the fish indices. And by now, the October fall midwater trawl has also been completed. The numbers are in. And I'll tell you just briefly how they look for October. And so the trend continues. Basically, things are looking pretty good. Delta smelt are doing even better in October than they did in September. Most of the delta smelt, as they were in September, have been caught in the Suisun Bay area, with the center right around X2, that magical number. A few, 6% in October, 5% in September, have been caught in the Cache Slough area, which is something we're also looking at. But most of them are in right in that low salinity zone right around X2 and Suisun Bay. The other fishes all are better, except the other fishes that we're looking at that have been a part of the pelagic organism decline investigations are longfin smelt, H0 striped bass, and threadfin shad. Longfin smelt and striped bass are doing better this year. Their September numbers were better than their October numbers. Threadfin shad is not looking as good in the index, which is calculated from the traditionally sampled stations. However, there are actually a lot of threadfin shad up in the Cache Slough area that aren't integrated into this index that's been reported now long term. So threadfin shad is a freshwater fish. It's probably not so surprising that they are found up there, which is, of course, freshwater in those numbers. So those are the general updates for the October fishes. And then let me just briefly say something about X2. I gave you in your attachment 1 to agenda item 6, I gave you a graph that shows monthly X2 for 3 years.
This is attachment 1, members.
Yes, attachment 1. 2006, which was the last wet year we had before 2011, and then 2009, which was, of course, a very dry year, and then now this year, 2011, in this graph here through October 12th. So obviously the October bar there for 2011 is only a partial monthly average. And as you can see, there are large differences. In the dry year, this X2 number is much higher, which means that X2 is much farther east into the Sacramento River, while in the wetter years, 2006 and 2011, it's much farther west. And there are, however, also interesting differences between 2006 and 2011, where in 2006, X2 was farther out west in the beginning of the year and then creeped farther east. At this time of the year, in the fall, it's actually been, it was higher in 2006, so farther east than it is this year. And we're interested in these sorts of things because we're of course interested in finding out why the fish are doing what they're doing and if this has anything to do with anything. So differences in these types, water year types, in how this develops are very interesting. And Delta smelt this year are actually doing a lot better than in 2006. The other fishes are doing approximately like they did in 2006. So all of this is of interest. It's under investigation, however, and I'm not going to say what the final results or conclusions from all of this might be because we're really working on this right now. And I do hope that we will be able to report to you sometime in the coming months when we have sorted these things out a little more.
And in 2 months, you'll be able to answer the question, how are the fish doing?
How are the fish doing? Certainly, as far as the fall is concerned, because in 2 months, this will be completed, the fall midwater trawl. Why are the fish doing how they're doing? Well, that's a different question. And, you know, there are so many things going on. This summer, this year was different in many ways. Obviously, what we're seeing now in the fall, especially in September, has much more to do with what happened in the previous months before the fall than it does with what's happening right now in the fall. As we are moving through the fall itself becomes more important. And so then what happens next year in terms of recruitment and so forth does have a lot to do with what happened with the entire year before, including the fall. And so those things are what we're trying to figure out.
Mr. Chair. Randy.
It's very interesting. Do you have any early reports on salmon counts?
Well, the salmon are doing a little better. It's early for fall and so forth, but they're doing apparently a little better on the feather and the McCollumy, and just now I saw on the Russian as well, although that's not so related. But that's looking quite encouraging. We were very interested in the winter run because they did very poorly this past go-around. And so they're the most endangered of them all. So we're very interested to see what happens with them. But obviously, they're not here yet. So.
Yes, Don.
Yeah, just a question. This was the year where we, for a few days, closed the cross channel, right? Any indicators on how that may or may not have benefited?
Again, that needs to be looked at more, but salmon in the McCollumy are apparently up a bit.
Again, whether that ties to that or not, because right. it was just a brief period. It was like 10 days or 15?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Could we say that all things considered, scientists would prefer to have a lot of rain every year than not?
No, actually, I think the preservationist types would prefer that, perhaps. The scientists would actually prefer what we have here, which is very different water years from one year to the next, because then we can learn something about it. We have different treatments.
Yeah. So you would caution us from overdrawing conclusions based on the information at hand.
Of course.
I'm just wondering.
Of course. But we will report back, and we do have a large, as you know, a large set of studies going on to investigate this more closely, and there will be reporting of all sorts, a science panel, and so forth.
Right. Yeah, members, you may remember from, I think, 2 or 3 months ago, Dr. Mueller-Solger had talked to us about the fact that the accumulation of data, there's a lot of data around, but the distillation of that data, the comparison, the cross-checking, I forget the phrase you used, the consolidation and evaluations of the data is not done as well as just the collection. And the absence of that comparisons and consolidations makes it hard to figure out from a policy basis what conclusions to draw.
That's correct, and that has a lot to do with the fact that we're barely able, with the staff that we currently have, to actually take the samples, barely, and then everything else comes way after, so there's the problem.
Yeah, and just speaking for myself, I'd be interested what you and the science program might suggest to encourage that consolidation of data and in attempts to standardize information, and whatever ideas you have, not today, not now, but in the future, it would be very useful to get some focus on that.
I just wanted to mention that at the last council meeting, Cliff presented his ideas for moving forward with the refined or revised science program, and that was part of it. That was one of the units that he recommends is focusing specifically on that.
Okay. All right. Anything else, members? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, members, we're next going to hear from the Independent Science Board, Dr. Norgaard. Yes, sir. It's on. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's not. I can't see it from there. And now it's
now
on.
It's on.
Now it's on.
Now it's on. Okay. So since seeing you last, speaking of conferences, I haven't been to any local conferences like State of the Bay Delta. But okay, I'm very close to this mic, but I...
Who'd ever heard of a soft-spoken economist, right?
I'm an ecological economist. I don't carry the reputation of the peers with whom I got my PhD. I was privileged to be able to be at the World Water Congress in Brazil since I saw you last. California was represented solely by me and Peter Glick. Arizona was much better represented, but that'll come up later in my discussion. I guess I can only report that the rest of the world is struggling much as we are. The World Water Congress has historically been a place where the big water project, dam builders, big planners, centralized development and delivery will solve everything by providing more, got together. And it's very much in the process of converting to, whoops, there's not much more to go after. We've got to recycle, we've got to reuse, we've got to think about efficiency in urban settings, we've got to adopt a climate change. So the rest of the world is struggling as we are. I think we're a little further ahead, but we may be more deeply aware of the problems we have. Whether we're further ahead, that's difficult to say. Mm-hmm. So back to the Science Board. I'm very pleased to say that the Independent Science Board has escaped your grasp. We're not trying to rank stressors or deal with the wording of the science plan. We have finally taken up our legislative mandate to start reviewing programs. On our meeting on October 20th, a week ago, we had four panels. people represent. Well, I should back up a little bit. Prior to the meeting, before we got started, the Delta Science Program staff prepared a questionnaire and sent it out to all of the science programs we thought there were in the agencies, federal and state, and some of the water districts or contractors. And we got a fairly good return, except for one agency we shall not name, that universally didn't return. But we got collected a lot of information in advance. The board reviewed that information, and then we had a selection of volunteers from the agencies come and talk with us. We organized them by water reliability, water quality, ecosystems, and risk reduction. So following the format of the, I guess we haven't escaped the plan entirely, have we? We have to think about that. And mostly queried on how science is being used, whether best available science is being used, and their understanding of adaptive management and what that entailed. I think we had our suspicions confirmed that it's going to take a fair amount of time to get adaptive management well in place, that there's a lot of learning to be done. The monitoring has to come up to speed to work with adaptive management. Probably most importantly, the idea of conceptual or analytical models that give you expectations that you then adapt from need to be put into place. We expected this, so this was mostly confirming, but it was important to learn. I think the board was also impressed that that the science staffs throughout the agencies are stressed, they're overburdened, they've lost staff, they don't have the support funding, they're not as able to travel as before. Things are just much more, it's just much more difficult to be a scientist in the agencies now. And so while we're asking new things to be done, more things to be done, changes to be made, it's a difficult situation for scientists throughout the system. Friday morning, we had the irreplaceable Mike Machado and researcher come, whose name I'm unfortunately not recalling at the moment.
Was that irreplaceable or irrepressible?
Say that just right so that you can't tell the difference?
Unresistible.
Irresistible. In this, all those things, we should learn a new word that blends them all together. This was the board's first encounter with sort of representatives of Delta as place. We've been interactive with numerous spokespeople and scientists for other aspects of the Delta plan, and Delta's place obviously needed to be touched base with. We were well aware that the economic sustainability plan is under review or about to go under review, and we didn't want to interfere in that review, but at the same time, we wanted to understand some of the background. The board was extremely impressed that the plan has a compilation in an orderly manner of an incredible amount of information. It's the only one-stop shop for Delta information that I, can recommend. That it was, the Delta as place is not a place in which data have been collected. And assembling the data from the 3 to 5 counties, depending on what you're dealing with, and bringing it together into one document is quite a feat and worth commending. At the same time, the board was concerned with some of the conclusions that were drawn from the data, but the board also needed to understand just sort of the structure of the Delta Protection Commission and the clientele it is speaking for and reporting back to and how it's composed. And so the complications of who it is as compared to the Department of Water Resources is it's a different organization to be working with, and it's harder for it to operate and doesn't have as long a history of collecting data and doing science. So the board is looking for ways to sort of help that process along and to increase the quality of the science in the Delta's Place area, and this was our first encounter to get that started. We were concerned that the Delta Sustainability Plan sort of starts with the assumption that all sectors of the economy not only are sustained but grow. We were concerned as sort of what are some of the implications for co-equal goals if we try to do that, and so we did push them a little bit on that. We then met as a board without some people speaking to us and struggled with how are we going to go through the review. 100 programs to review is not what we want to do. They don't assemble into easy little categories. They're interconnected and overlapping. They cooperate with each other. How to parse them was a major question. I can't say that we've answered that. Instead, we took another tact and said, we need to prepare or help the Delta Science Program prepare a science plan. And at some point, we'd also be like to be communicating on the state of Delta Science. So, you know, maybe somewhere out there there's a state of Delta Science report again. And why would we want to be reviewing science programs in a manner that wasn't contributing to our understanding of how to develop a state of or a Delta Science plan? But then also, can't we do this in a manner that contributes to sort of a communication that's not just between us and the science programs, but is a broader form of communication? We're not yet making all of those linkages, but we are trying to combine the activities, or at least make them as complementary as possible, partly to make our time effective, but partly, of course, because staff time is extremely scarce. But the next step we decided was to look at sort of the other users, sort of not in the adaptive management 9-step circle users of science, but the users of science in the legislative staff, amongst the water boards, the reclamation boards, the users of science and the contributors of science in academe and the NGO think tanks, and to bring them to the Independent Science Board to talk about how science working from their perspective, but also any ideas they may have to contribute toward a Delta Science Plan. So we're using the board as a sort of a hearing device to start preparing the Delta Science Plan.
What's your guess about the timeline needed to get through just that discrete topic?
The Delta Science Plan? The board helps to have its contributions for the science program before we're hit by the EIR from BDCP. So we're talking June, July, yeah. And then that provides the rest of the time to actually put the plan together.
This mention of trying to assess, bring together the main agencies with science activity and assess their interaction, cooperation, whatever the words are, is that's of course just part of the overall puzzle. But that's, are you going to lead with that, do you think?
I think we're mostly interested in that in terms of how to contribute to the science plan, how that cooperation and interaction can be sustained and improved, or, you know, if it's excessive, how it can be made more efficient. But it is also symptomatic of our problem of how do you parse science programs for review, in that if they're highly interactive, then you really want to look at them as a group. And so,
do you think the board is likely to provide us, as we read your report, your information, with examples of other structures in science that might be helpful to consider? Because I keep looking for, you know, something that is could be viewed as a more effective science program organized somewhere that's actually in operation.
Yes. We have had discussions, and frankly, Chesapeake Bay, but it hasn't had as organized a science plan as we're trying to talk about. And so we can think of other places, but have they actually developed a science plan, or have they been bumbling along? And so we can talk about how other regional, you know, environmental issues are handled and how the scientists are interactive and not. But we haven't identified a science plan like we're hoping to prepare.
Okay. Yeah. Randy?
That surprises me, because I would have thought the Everglades or the Great Lakes would have provided those types of models.
Well, I spoke with Great Lakes person. I have that contact. She will be sending me what she has, but she couldn't describe it as a science plan. And so, yes, so the World Water Congress contacts got me there. Florida, we have other ways to contact. Joe?
Yeah, I wanted to point out, I guess it's no surprise in our society, although it was a surprise to me because I hadn't focused on it, that there are 100 different science programs, if you will, different entities doing science in the Delta. And when the science program sent out asking for people to respond, I think they got more than 50 of them to respond. So
which is remarkable.
Which is remarkable, yes. But that it points out there's a lot going on, and it isn't all well coordinated, and probably the best we can hope for in the end is not that any one entity will control it all, but that there is an effective network so we don't waste too much time and money as we do it.
Well, we're on the council, we're going to rely on Ms. Marcus, who has experience herding scientists at the federal level.
There you go. That means I really owe him coffee.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yeah, so we really need to have coffee.
You need to have that coffee, I promise.
Yes.
At the risk of diverting the discussion a little bit further, you mentioned money. Will those 100 programs show up on our budget worksheet that we're creating to identify where what activities are currently underway in the Delta and where the money is being spent, where it comes
probably
from?
The major ones would show up, but not, you know, there's a huge number of, the sanitation district has its own science program. There are many, many of those that are out there that we just don't normally think about, and we probably won't put all of that because we're not capable of getting that all done in this time frame. As I said, not even close to all of the science programs responded to the inquiries from our science program, so it'll take some time to get there.
I just think one of our roles is to synthesize and to coalesce. If there's overlap, I mean, if it's a surprise to the experts that there are this many programs going on, it suggests to me that there's probably some overlap and that one of our roles ought to be to call that out and maybe suggest some consolidation.
Absolutely. Light is really important, and shining a light on what's happening is an important role for the council to play.
And is this supposed to be where I recommend that all the people identified as scientists in collective Delta issues should wear standardized uniforms so we know who they are and where they are and they can recognize each other too?
This was surely solved.
Is something to that notion that if you can't easily distinguish who's doing activities that are scientific in nature, it's hard to coordinate, let alone if you can't know, you can't coordinate. So anyway, interesting. Okay. All right. Dr. Norgaard, anything else you want to tell us?
No.
I was trading conversation with a young PhD candidate who was interested in science and some of the folks at the National Academy, and they shipped out to this lady a paper on how science and public policy didn't get along and did get along, and there you were in your research quoted extensively in the middle of the paper.
Oh, I guess I better see this paper.
Oh, you've seen it before. I'll shoot you a copy.
Okay.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, sir. Okay. Joe, I think we just ought to go straight into the Delta Plan development,
yes,
if you would. And maybe you could... You've structured the rest of the schedule to discreetly evaluate different components. Tell us how the rest of the agenda works, and who's going to do it and all that kind of stuff?
Well,
overview, I guess, first.
Overview. I'm going to talk about the Delta Plan in general terms, what we've done, what we're doing. I want to go through the schedule. You note that we have a council schedule here in front of you, and I want to talk through that and how we might move ahead with that schedule. And then we'll bring up the panel on the EIR that will include Gwen and the attorneys, and they'll talk about how what's happening with the EIR, and they have a presentation about that. So we'll talk about that and how we plan to move through to get to adoption of a Delta plan. So and I think the schedule is the key thing just to start off with. It's clear, as I announced earlier, releasing the draft of the EIR next Friday, the 4th, and giving a 60-day comment period gets us to January 3rd. We won't meet the deadline of adopting a Delta plan by the 1st of January. And I'm disappointed with that, but I cannot fault staff or consultants for the work that they've been doing on that. It's a very complex process. I've never done an EIR of this complexity before in my career, so I didn't understand how difficult it would be to get this done. So it is what it is. In terms of schedule, we're anticipating two public hearings. So at both the November meeting, which is scheduled, I think, for, I should look, I put it out here so I could tell you the dates. The 17th and 18th of November. On the 17th, we're anticipating a public hearing in the afternoon on the EIR. And then on also the 15th of December, we anticipate a public hearing on the EIR. Now, there has been a request. Member Gray had a request from some stakeholders that we extend the comment period beyond January 3rd. And when we get our attorneys up here in the next item, we'll talk about the possibilities for doing that. There are some rules about that, regulations about EIRs that we have to be aware of when we discuss that. Assuming that we don't do that, the plan would be we get all of the comments back in the first part of January, January 3rd. We spend a couple of weeks compiling all of those, trying to understand them, and bring them to the council in the meeting on the 26th and 27th. And on that, at that meeting, we bring in two compilations. One is comments on the fifth draft, and we've gotten a good response on that. We have hundreds of pages of comments on the fifth draft plan that we've been trying to compile into a table, as you've seen before, that we did with comments, but also trying to synthesize so that we can, in a meaningful way, explain what we think we've heard. And then give you options about what to do with the plan. And the same with the EIR. I expect there will be as many comments on the EIR, maybe hundreds of pages, maybe thousands of pages more. And so the plan is that we come back in January with summaries of those things, try and lay out what decisions have been made, what recommendations staff has, and then ask you on issues, what is it the council, what direction you want to give us so that we can develop what will then be the sixth draft of the Delta plan. It will be informed by all the comments on the fifth draft and the comments on the EIR. The plan would be that we get that direction from you, and we probably bring that to a meeting on at the 23rd and 24th of February. You will note on the draft calendar we have the 9th and 10th held for potential meetings, and the reason we did that is we were not sure that we could actually get through all of that discussion in the first in the meetings in January, and we thought, well, we better be prepared and
I think you're right to do that. It's inconceivable to me that we're not going to need some more meeting times. These may not be exactly the days, and you may need to shift them around differently, but for at least the February and March, and you've got a follow-up.
And we have a follow-up in April because we wanted to be prepared.
I think that's
in the end,
to flag those.
The decision is a challenging one for you, and we want to give the council the best opportunity and the best information so that my expectation is we will take direction from you and we'll try and point out where the key issues are, take direction from you on what you want to see in the sixth draft, and we'll produce that, hopefully bring that back to you at the end of February, and again, get feedback and get direction and use that to develop a seventh draft, which we put out in mid-March with the potential for a decision the 29th and 30th of March. Now, that could be delayed. That's why we have the extra days here. Where we're at is probably 3 to 4 months behind schedule, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, the nature of this business. I should mention that if, as we get through the EIR and we get all the comments and we make the recommended changes to the Delta plan, if we make changes that aren't covered by the EIR, it's possible that we'll have to recirculate.
Right.
And if that happens, the schedule goes back again by another two or three months. So just be aware of that. But right now, our best estimate is that by the end of March or the first part of April, we should be able to adopt a Delta plan. And at that point, forward the regulatory part to the Office of Administrative Law for their period. But the plan would then be adopted, and we could start working with that.
Okay. Their question, Ms. Gray.
It's comments. Okay. Thank you, Joe, for going through the schedule. And I think it's important that we do a thoughtful plan. And, of course, the schedule is behind, but I think that's necessary to come out with our best effort. I know that the 60-day comment period after ERR review is done. I know it's longer than our 45-day period that we're supposed to do. And I know there are holidays, and I think you've taken that into consideration. But I just kind of want to put on the table the option of 90 days, because November, December, you're going to lose a lot of time period there because of the holidays. So we may want to think about it at the next meeting, kind of look at the fact that we extend it to 90 days if necessary. I know there's a lot of interest out there because this document, the ERR document, is extremely important to the development of the plan. So I'm suggesting thinking about 90 days just to make sure that everyone has an effort to comment. I know that the stakeholders certainly have been a part of the process and they're aware of what's in the ERR, but I think the 90-day may be something that the council should consider.
Let's do this. At the next meeting, we'll have the EIR out. You guys are going to take a look at the draft schedule, and you'll talk to us about any refinements. I mean, Lord knows what that would be. This question will be around. I'm sure there are people going to say they want 6 months or a year to see it. But let's just flag that for the next meeting and a report on the time schedule. Relating to the EIR and the Delta plan. Yes, Don.
Sure. Does that then require, because Joe alluded to it, that there might be some other legal action required, but I mean, this council then could extend that comment period just by noticing it?
I don't know if these are the right words legally, but if we make significant changes in the Delta plan that were not evaluated in the environmental impact report, certainly in the regulatory aspect, we may be compelled to recirculate the process, which would have its own time constraints.
Right.
I don't know whether that's quite true for narrative, for textual changes, and some of the other stuff. And you don't have to tell us now.
We'll get into that when the panelists come up. But I think that the idea on the table now is just extending the public comment
right.
period. And obviously that's within your discretion, and mm-hmm. we'll take
right.
a look
okay,
at
well,
it.
Okay, well, that was my take on it, but again, this process may be a little different than what I'm familiar with, but again, this is a massive enough effort, I think, Ms. Gray's request to give people adequate time, recognizing folks, and I think Joe's trying to keep everything on track here, but reasonable time frame for people to respond, then all the work that comes behind that, the analysis that then informs the next draft of the plan, that's the burden then shifts, at least in good part, to the staff, consultants, and others. They have to then, you know, hurry up and respond. So, okay, thanks.
Yeah, and again, the panelists will refresh our memory about what the rules are and what the custom is with regard to comment periods, and I think that'll be
the rules and the custom.
Well, they actually have a statute and a guideline.
Lawyers don't talk about custom.
No, okay. Well,
do they?
How about we'll do what's right?
Okay, we'll do it today. Okay. All right.
A couple of other items to mention. One, we are planning to schedule a follow-up work session on covered actions. As we had talked about before, Keith's working on that. I had a request from Ms. Gray that we consider having a follow-up work session on governance.
Yes, governance. I know that there's a session, a follow-up session on covered action, but I would like to see that whole chapter expanded, the governance chapter, because the Council Member Marcus has really shown leadership in bringing that issue up, and I think we need to talk about it more because it's very important to you know, folks buying into what the concept is. And I heard Randy say that one of our roles is to synthesize, and so all of that I think needs to be kind of discussed as it relates to that chapter. And I do believe that work session has really been a good way for to improve communication and opportunities for folks to kind of sit around the table and talk about a single issue and be more focused. And I think it's brought clarity to some issues, and even with the covered action issue, I know there were some people at the last workshop who had examples of what, you know, they weren't sure if it was a covered action, and your staff was there to kind of walk through the process. So I think it's important that people do the same thing at our next follow-up workshop to bring examples and really kind of vet it with staff to see if it makes sense. So again, I think it is a model that we should consider moving forward, to have work sessions as needed on different items or issues that need clarity, or chapters that need clarity. So again, I'm proposing that we expand it to governance. Finance is another chapter I think we should have a work session on, because I don't think we had enough time, and Randy certainly provided leadership in that area, and I think it'll give opportunities for folks to really give their ideas as well as what we believe, and Randy kind of set the framework for it. So I'm proposing those workshop sessions.
Why don't I ask Keith to come back at the next meeting and talk to us about how we might proceed.
Thank you.
Okay, good. All right, anything else on the overview? Okay, Mr. Grindstaff, how do you want to proceed?
I'd like to...
File 8?
Yes.
Okay. You're in charge. Okay.
Or file 9.
Number 9. That is correct. Ms. Buchholz, Mr. Christoffel, Mr. Andrew, and Ms. Garber. And ladies and gentlemen, if you will excuse me, I'm headed off to my memorial service. Randy will take charge. Thank you.
I just want to state for the record, I was a little uncomfortable sitting to your left, so.
So who wants to lead off?
I didn't want to step on the chair's departure, so we're going to let him go and then speak, let him go out with full attention. So good morning. We've been here before. I'm Jim Andrew from the Attorney General's office, and I'll let my co-panelists introduce themselves.
Can I say these four people have worked 2 months straight? I don't think they've had a day off in 2 months, so I appreciate very much, and I think everyone here should appreciate very much the time all four of them and many of their staff have put in.
On behalf of the council, I want to echo those comments. I know you've all been busting your tails to capture this thing and get it done well and get it done right. And in an era where there is not a lot of great morale in governmental offices, I just want to offer words of encouragement and thanks for staying with the course, and I guess we're on the precipice of delivering a product, and it's appreciated, and the delay's understandable.
Mr. Vice Chair, I just would ditto that and offer applaud all of you and your teams for your work, and again, you give up, you know, obviously it's part of the work, and you sacrifice the time and all the other things get put aside, but certainly very much appreciate
it. We all thank you. I'm Ellen Garber with the law firm of Shoot, Mahaly & Weinberger.
I'm David Christoffel with CH2M Hill.
I'm Gwen Buchholz with CH2M Hill.
So we've been here before, and the purpose of today's presentation is it's relatively short, and it's to give you just a preview, not of the of any specific conclusions, but of the schedule for the EIR, which Joe went through, and I'll go through in brief detail, and then kind of the conceptual approach that we took to formulating the EIR, so that both you and the public and stakeholders have a framework to recognize and to look through when they get the EIR. I think it'll be helpful for everybody. So that's the purpose of today's discussion. So we're going to go through quick status update, and it's mostly Joe's already talked about it, so I'll go through that fast. The public outreach and EIR availability, just so that you know and the public knows how the EIR will be available, et cetera. We'll go through quickly the approach to the EIR analysis, again, how we approached the formulation of it. Again, the framework for understanding what you and the stakeholders will see, it's an important part of this. And again, we're not going to be presenting any specific conclusions, talking about anything of a specific nature. It's premature at this time to do that, particularly before we've actually had the benefit of the public comment. It's called a draft EIR for a reason. It's a draft. It's put out there on the street for people to review and comment, and then you take those comments, you're informed by them, adjust the analysis as necessary, and then we put together what's called the final EIR, which is really the fully formed and fully informed document, and at that point, probably in a little bit in January, a little bit more in February, but probably more in March when all of the comments have been received and we've taken the time to respond to them in writing, we'd be in a position to really present the full and fully informed through public and stakeholder comment conclusions of the EIR. So again, status update, it'll be released on a week from tomorrow, 60 review period ending January 3rd. Most of the comments will come in writing. We will take them by mail. We have an email address specific for the EIR. We're also going to set up the website so that you can just go to the website and hit click here and submit a comment on the EIR. As Joe mentioned, we're providing two opportunities for oral public comments so that folks who want to come in and not have to write something down but want to come in and provide an oral comment can do so. That's not required under CEQA. But we're doing it anyway and actually holding two of those, and it's from 1 to 4:30 on the 17th and the November 17th and December 15th. There'll be a court reporter there who will actually transcribe the comments verbatim so that we make sure we get it down so that we can accurately respond to the comments.
I know it's not legally required, but this doesn't seem like enough to me for oral comment. That amount of time, a few hours, two different afternoons, just seems kind of small. I mean, I've done all day public comment hearings on stuff that's not as big as this. So one of the things I know will be presumably during the course of this period, do you have plan any workshops to walk people through it, or will you be walking us through it before the comment deadline so that people have plenty of time to go through the Emily Latella phase, which is what I call it, which is they read it, it's not exactly what you had in mind, so they end up commenting on something that's not what you had in mind, and so they lose their shot to comment on what you did have in mind. So I'm kind of a fan of going through certain public workshops or whatever on something this important early, just so that people are clear on what it is that you mean in the document, and then giving them another shot at the oral. I know it's not required. I just think, given how controversial it is and how much of the, is my own editorial, how much of the dialogue in California Water is talking past each other, it just strikes that that more time might be in order. But you may have something else in mind.
We didn't have anything planned beyond this, except that when we produce the final EIR, which will be taking everybody's comments and responding to those comments in writing, mm-hmm. that will be released for public, to the public. And depending on the schedule and how the council and Joe want to do the schedule, now that final EIR has to be released for a minimum of 10 days. That's just the bare minimum. But there'll be an opportunity for people to comment on on that document.
I just want to make sure that people's shot in their written and their oral comments is really a good, clear shot.
Well, what I had thought we would do is not as part of the public comment period, but earlier in the day on the first meeting, and maybe we need to do it the same the second meeting too, is actually have Gwen and David, or maybe all four of you, come and walk through the EIR and explain it and answer questions about what it's intended to do. Try and explain what's in there so that it's so that's not part of the public comment period. That's part of staff walking through this very complex document, trying to explain, now what did you say about greenhouse gas emissions, and why did you say that, and mm-hmm. how did you compare the alternatives there, and just it's not something, at least for me, that is usually done. But given this document and its controversy and the implications for everybody, I think it would be important to just kind of walk through and explain what we say in writing. And I know the attorneys will be nervous, but it's my belief that education is really important. And
yeah, I just question whether that's enough. I'm glad you're thinking about doing it. It seems like it might be better to do it as a separate standalone meeting, so people have a chance to digest it before they get up to talk. But I know there are two shots. They can come back. I just envision a lot more people, for example, showing up than the regulars, because people who normally are watching this on the web may want to show up to say their piece. Now, a lot of people may just write it, and the written ones are really helpful. But I'm not saying what we ought to do. I'm just asking the question, because I've always erred on excess in this, because if you spend more time on workshops where people understand it and can ask questions, you're going to get better comments later on. And I'm just worried about the public losing their shot to give informed
comments. So you're
comments.
Asking for us to consider workshops in addition to the formal public comment period where we actually explain things, answer questions.
Yeah, I like that you're thinking about doing it in the morning. That does answer my question. I'm just questioning whether that's enough or this will be enough time.
Yeah, just before Jim responds, I would say that I would concur with sufficient time for oral comment. Again, having sat through enough processes over the years, and you know, big and small as it relates, nothing as big as this, obviously, but I would just say that, you know, 6 hours sounds like a lot, or 7 hours, I guess, but I think that, you know, recognizing the depth and the breadth, and I think the potential impacts, whatever might be there being weighed in the environmental document, that I think having some explanation, that's good. I concur with that, but I'm not so sure that these blocks of time, again, these aren't restrictive in the sense, but I mean, people set their schedules by them and so forth. I just think I would anticipate that you may have a lot more folks show up, because this is going to be time from a standpoint, certainly the legal aspects of environmental documentation and how you record things and so forth. Again, I don't understand all the details behind that, but I would just say that I think that this may be a little bit confining as it relates to the number of folks who may want to weigh in, you know, verbally and present actually before this, in addition to anything they would submit in writing or through other communication. So,
yeah, just one other thing to toss into the mix. I, And maybe you're going to get to it. I just jumped in too soon. I was sort of expecting that we would have field hearings on this. Field hearings, that we'd go to Southern California, the Delta, Northern California, just so people don't have to travel to Sacramento.
To give you a sense of, this is the way to talk about custom, and Chair Eisenberg's not here to joke about that, but I mean, there is the CEQA process and how it is normally done is if you provide an opportunity for people to come in and provide comment, it's largely a one-way communication. It's one where they get an opportunity to come in and present their comment on the record rather than have to do it in writing. The opportunity for the dialogue back and forth happens at the final, generally, this is how the custom works, after the final EIR, when all the process and comments are in and staff has had a chance to deal with those comments, and then the final conclusions of the EIR are presented, and that's more where the dialogue happens. It's kind of like the way I see it, you know, you put out draft plans, you put the draft plans out, you know, some period of time before a meeting, then it's presented, and the public has had a chance to look at that, and so it's a fully informed dialogue when they're looking at the draft plan because it's been out, people have had a chance to review it, and they're coming here talking about all of it. It's of a similar nature. But, you know, we can do whatever the council and staff decide is appropriate and want to do.
So what I'm hearing from council members is at least two of them very much want to make sure that we don't limit the ability of people to have input into this. I'm perfectly fine if it's okay with the attorneys to adding more time. I think your point is that the most productive dialogue is likely to come after the close of the formal comment period and in the time when the council is formulating its response to comments and deciding what the final plan will be and before the final EIR is certified.
Right.
Is that your point?
Right. It's taken us a lot of effort in the last couple of months to put this together. It'll take commenters some time to understand the document, and then it'll take us some time to really understand and digest the really helpful comments that we will get. It's not something that lends itself to at that point when it's still in the gestation stage, that lends itself well to a dialogue until everybody's had the benefit of each other's comments. But we can, walking people through the conclusions in the EIR, we can do. There's no harm in extending the comment, from 4:30 to whenever the staff wants to do it, or
go to the next day. I mean, the alternative, it's very relatively easy to say the 17th and 18th and take all day on the 18th, and the same thing with the 15th and 16th and take all day on the 16th, and then we can talk about where the meetings are at. My sense is actually, in spite of all of the that people in other parts of the state might be interested, that this area is where we will get the best participation.
It may well be, but there's an education function that we're not hitting yet at all. So there's an opportunity, for the people who can't afford to come here who are interested, because our whole point is it's about the state interest, mm-hmm. which includes the interests of people in different places. And it's also an opportunity to go out there and highlight some of these issues in areas that either have no awareness of it or a partial awareness. I just tend to prefer front-loading the time for people to really understand it. I'm still having trouble understanding the end of process thing. I get the dialogue. I'm not talking about having a dialogue early. I'm just talking about making sure people actually understand what's meant in it so that when they do comment, they know what they're saying and can give us more constructive comments. So I just think more is better, and some time frame in between so they have a chance. So I like your idea of maybe extending it to 2 days. And it doesn't mean the whole council has to go to the field, but somebody's got to go in the field.
In fact, council doesn't even have to do it at all if you don't choose to. We can set up a hearing, and I could conduct it so that we could do that. Is that so? I will take that suggestion, and we'll talk about that. Let's see if we can improve the amount of time.
And, just to give you an idea of a parallel process, the high-speed rail EIRs were just out on the streets, and they had hearings to take public comment. And they were usually one or two of the board members with a staff person to take comment. And they were held in various locations in the affected area. And the I think the number of folks who commented was a lot, but we scheduled the timing roughly about the same windows as here in a few different locations, and it didn't prove to be grossly too short, just to give you a relative comparison.
Gloria, yeah. And Don, and then James, we can let you get on with your report.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to echo Councilmember Marcus. I think you suggested having a session in Southern California because it is in our state interest. And, you know, I think it's, again, an opportunity for folks to really understand, get clarity, and provide comment. And I do think that council members should be at those sessions as much as we can, because we certainly can hear from different stakeholders. So, again, I just wanted to echo my support for what she suggested. And I'm sorry I have to leave, but I did want to make those comments to you. Thank you.
Randy, just very quick, Mr. Chair. I would concur again. I know it means additional work and setup time and so forth, but I think that what we did when we were doing the background for the plan development, that, again, those workshops were done, you know, up and down the state, and they were requiring certainly a lot of, you know, attention and you know, pre-arrangements. But recognizing that in all cases you had members of the council, not necessarily, you know, a quorum present, but at those different ones. I think it's useful, and I think it may help as you narrow in on then obviously the remaining portion of the process to gather those comments there. And again, a lot of people do it by mail, but I mean this has enough impact both regionally but certainly statewide. I think that it would serve the purpose of developing this plan and the environmental comments and that portion of it by having those field meetings. I don't think, you know, you need to do multiples, but certainly geographically and recognizing holidays are in the midst here, and that may even argue more strongly towards a 90-day comment period to try to facilitate, you know, some of if it go forward with some field hearings on the environmental comments period. Thanks.
Jim, would you like to proceed?
So we will have those hearings and more, which is great. I think that's a good idea. And we had talked about having one down in the Delta region. And like I said, the high-speed rail EIRs we had distributed out throughout the location of the rail project, so it made sense to bring the public in. So the EIR will be available at the council's website. There'll be a hard copy or a CD-ROM, depending on the library, whether they can take a CD-ROM at the main county library in most parts of the state, you know, everywhere where the Delta plan has influence. I think there's a map that's in the Delta plan itself that kind of runs up the Sacramento Valley and all the way down to LA and even down into San Diego. So we've got pretty wide distribution. And then if folks want a CD-ROM, they can request one and we'll send them one. And the notice of availability of the EIR is going to be widely distributed. It'll be published in many newspapers across the state. We'll be sending a copy of the EIR to most state agencies that have any possible connection with the Delta plan and water interests. So just to give you a sense of what the EIR contains, it'll have the description of the project, and the project here, as we've mentioned before, is the fifth staff draft Delta plan, and then five alternatives, and we'll talk about the alternatives in a minute. There's analysis across 19 different environmental resource sections, and I'm not going to read them all, but it just gives you a sense of the breadth and length of the analysis. There's a comparison of the alternatives, of course, and the EIR is about 2,000 pages, including all the appendices, so it's a big technical document. And I do want to stress that this is a technical document. It's an analytical document, not a policy document. I've said that before, but I think it's important to understand that it's a document of technical analysis, and the comments that we really will want and welcome is comments on the accuracy of that technical analysis, not comments about the pluses and minuses of the political aspects or the policy aspects of the Delta plan itself. That's for the Delta plan.
I think that's actually a good point, and we may need to sort of in the annotated sort of version for the public of our, when we get the notices out, they should understand where they can do the policy comments as on the plan and how those are going to interrelate, which will be you talked about in the beginning, but we probably need to spell that out pretty clearly for people so that they can focus on it. We may need to give an outlet or a timing, you know, for people to be able to talk about the policy. But I fully expect that as technical as it is, it reads lyrically, doesn't it?
It reads like a beautiful story.
As we were talking and thinking about going to different areas of the state, I was thinking, okay, maybe what we do is actually have both the formal comment period for the EIR, but also have a workshop on the plan and talk about what is in the plan and give people an opportunity to talk about the policy issues, because I think we probably will have more engagement on that than we would on the technical issues in the EIR. So doing both, so maybe that's a good opportunity.
A couple other points is that the EIR itself does not evaluate whether the FIST staff draft Delta plan or the alternatives meet the co-equal goals. That's a job for staff and ultimately the council. Again, it's focused on environmental impacts of the FIST staff draft and the alternatives, not on whether they'll meet the co-equal goals. It's a technical analysis. And the ability of the project and alternatives to meet those goals is something that the staff will bring forward at some later point in time. It's probably sooner rather than later, but it's not part of the EIR. It doesn't have to be under CEQA. It's not. It is part of the CEQA process towards the end, and we'll probably bring this out sooner rather than later, but it doesn't have to be part of the draft EIR itself. Again, it's focused on analytical and impacts. So conceptually, the Delta plan itself, it includes policies and recommendations that encourage other agencies to take actions. You're not authorizing any particular construction projects, but we assume that the Delta plan will be successful. And because you are have policies and recommendations that try and spur other agencies into taking actions that will reach the co-equal goals or achieve the co-equal goals, we assume that the Delta plan will be successful and that those different project types will actually happen. So what we did is we looked at the different types of physical actions that could occur that other agencies could take in response to the Delta plan, because you're sort of spurring them on, in some cases with covered actions with a little more force, and in case with non-covered actions and with respect to recommendations, sort of through the bully pulpit. But we assumed all of that would actually happen, and sort of, and then came up with a list of project types that would result or could result from the Delta plan being successful. And this is just obviously a non-exclusive list: new reservoirs, water treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, agricultural runoff treatment plants, new habitat areas, expanded or entirely new habitat areas, levee improvements, either improvements to existing levees or new levees, new Delta recreation facilities. And in most cases, the Delta plan obviously doesn't call out particular or authorize construction of particular projects. It's more typology. In some cases, you're advocating moving forward with the water studies that include certain new projects like the Los Vaqueros Reservoir. I'll get into that in a minute. But it was mostly a typology analysis that we did. What types of projects and where generally could they possibly occur if the Delta plan actually, where you ran the table and it was a big success? So we assumed that the types of projects will occur and evaluated their typical environmental impacts. And we, to make it consistent with the Delta plan, we identified those projects across the five topic areas that the Delta plan itself targets, which is reliable water supply projects, Delta ecosystem restoration projects, water quality improvement projects, flood risk reduction projects, and Delta as place enhancement projects. And so that's the way the EIR is set up, to look at the types of physical actions and projects that might fall under those five categories that might help push towards the co-equal goals, if the Delta plan is successful. And it's important to recognize that this EIR is a program EIR. It is not a project-level EIR. We did not look at the particular intersections of where traffic could go through if you built a new levee somewhere in the Delta. It's not that level. It's a program document. And when other agencies actually implement any of these possible projects in the future, they'll do the precise analysis. So it's a higher-level typology-type analysis. But the consultants had a stroke of genius. They said, well, if we just come up with an EIR that generally talks about types of projects, it's going to be so high level and so fuzzy and so amorphous, it's not going to be all that helpful. So how do we, without actually knowing where actual projects will be, what their precise siting location or siting will be, how big they're going to be, what the operational characteristics are going to be, what the construction period we're going to be, we can't make that, completely make that up, and we don't know it. So what do we do? And they said, well, we're not talking about types of projects that have never been done before. People, other agencies have done it before. So why don't we look at the environmental documents that have been done and completed for other similar analogous projects and see what that tells us. And that was a brilliant stroke of genius, because once we decided to do that, or once they came up with the idea and we all decided to do it, it added an incredible amount of depth to the EIR and setting. Oh, okay, the light bulb goes off. I get what that might be. And we, of course, you know, it's our job to independently come up with conclusions. So we didn't just say, well, that document said this, so therefore it means that. We said, you know, we used our independent judgment, but it really was provided a tremendous amount of information. It's a bit, you know, unusual in a CEQA document to do that, but it's actually tremendous in terms of providing input and understanding. And so we use, and here, I mean, there's an example right here, is the Davis Woodland Water Supply Project. I mean, Davis Woodland just went through a vote to expand their water supply to get off groundwater and or at least minimize groundwater and pull water from the Sacramento River. You know, it's a big project, and there's different components to it. There's a new intake, there's pipelines, there's a treatment plant, and you know, the Delta Plan itself doesn't call for this project to happen, but the types of things the Delta Plan calls for are similar in nature, and so we relied on those types of analogous projects and their environmental analysis, which is, again, stroke of genius and really helpful. Of course, in some cases, the Delta Plan does name particular, either directly or indirectly, particular projects. The ISI, Independent... Yeah, integrated storage investigations. We just use the shorthand. I've forgotten the acronym. I've forgotten what it means. But integrated storage investigations, which, you know, we know what those are, at least some of them. An example is the Los Vaqueros Reservoir Expansion Phase 2. Phase 1 is already either done or substantially underway. But Phase 2 is something that is, questionable whether it'll happen. But there's been an environmental document on it, so we looked at that document. Another example is the Sassoon Marsh Habitat Restoration Project, which is indirectly called out in the Delta Plan, and there has been an EIR on it. So we looked at it and report what it says in this EIR. And it's, again, really helpful way to go. So the EIR does, and this is compelled by CEQA, it takes a conservative view. And again, because we don't know specific project details, the EIR, you know, for example, concludes that impact could be significant based on a single example when we look out there. You know, one of them is, you know, an analogous project required 24-hour construction for some water-related, I don't know if it was a levee or an intake or something, and I'm guessing it was because you can't have your construction workers split and then the water probably leaks overnight, so I'm guessing that's how it had to happen. So with 24-hour construction noise, because the way noise analysis is done, the threshold for acceptable noise is a lot lower at night, if there's people around, of course, for sleeping. And so because of that example, you know, this EIR is taking the conservative approach and saying, you know, it's possible that noise impacts during construction could be significant, because we don't really know precisely that, we can't say definitively that all of the projects that would be constructed would not involve 24-hour noise. So we took a conservative approach because CEQA compels that. If we can't definitively say that there won't be any impacts, and we have evidence that a couple of our representative projects had impacts, then we conclude that those impacts could be significant.
How do you? I understand why that is, and I generally like a conservative approach to that, but how have you worked around making everything meaningless as a result? Because if you assume that everything could be 24 hours, that means levee construction, storage count also means low-impact development projects in Southern California, and anything would have potential significant impact. So how have you navigated that so that there's something discernible in it, or there are enough caveats that we're not going to end up with a bunch of comments assuming that everything's awful all the time?
No, we that was something we have spent some time struggling with.
I figured you have.
Yeah, I mean, how, you don't want to just throw something out that says the Delta Plan is going to be the end of the world because you're calling everything significant. So we have some there's qualifiers and qualification in the document. And, you know, in this case, we'd say, well, in most cases, and if not in the vast majority of cases, construction noise impacts will be less than significant, except for situations such as. So we have actually called out, if it's not obvious that it will be significant, if there's these exceptions, these outliers that could result in it being significant, we have called those out to give people a sense of the context. And we've also used a little technique in the executive summary table that attempts to, it's not color-coded. I wanted color-coding, but because of black and white photocopies, it probably wouldn't work. But, you know, kind of yellow is, it's significant, but probably only in a very few times. Yellow or orange would be, it's kind of, you know, sometimes it will be, sometimes it won't be. And then red would be, you know, these are the ones that are kind of a big deal. So we have tried to distinguish and grade them so that it isn't meaningless. And, yeah, you're very astute to recognize that that was a problem, and we have come up with workarounds to make it more useful. And we didn't assume, there are plenty of impacts that are less than significant, too. We didn't, you know, if we couldn't think of something that would possibly be significant, we said, well, it's not significant. We can't think of anything. But it does take a conservative approach. And I think even with the yellow, orange, red scheme or its equivalent, the document will come across as being conservative, and it's compelled by CEQA. And you could have legal vulnerabilities if you don't take that approach. It's just the way. CEQA is very helpful in lots of different ways, and will be very helpful in this process. But it also can skew things in a direction that forces you to take a more conservative approach. So we've tried to strike a balance between being legally conservative and helpful. And then the other piece of this is with respect to mitigation. Of course, you know, all environmental documents call out impacts, and they say, well, this is how you could minimize or mitigate that impact, and list mitigation measures. Because the council for non-covered actions can't guarantee that an agency who might do a project that you want them to do actually imposes that mitigation, we had to conclude that those impacts could be significant and unavoidable because you don't have the legal authority to require them to do so in the case of non-covered actions. And that's that conclusion, that they could be significant and unavoidable, is also compelled by CEQA. But again, to Ms. Marcus's comment, we did some gradations in there that basically said the only reason that this it could be significant and unavoidable in, you know, a case where we are pretty certain the mitigation would actually work, we say, well, it could be significant and unavoidable except for this legal reason that you can't force people to do it. In situations where the efficacy or feasibility of the mitigation is a little more in question, we call that out as well, again, to give you some sense of helpfulness without being ridiculously overly conservative. And we hope, you know, we've done our best to do that, and we think it'll be clear, but I think we'll get some comments on that. We may need to adjust. So the alternatives, and we've been here before presenting to you the alternatives, but just as a reminder, CEQA requires you to look at the no project alternative, which is basically not adopting the Delta plan. And the no project alternative doesn't mean nothing happens, because there are various processes underway, various projects that are funded, ongoing. You know, Los Vaqueros Phase 1 is one of them, the no project situation, that would still go forward. And so to provide a basis for comparison, we actually looked at, well, what will the world look like if we all just disappeared here? Well, the world won't stop with respect to water projects and the like. So that's what the no project contains. Then alternative 1A is based on comments by the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. 1B is based on a proposal by the Ag-Urban Coalition. Alternative 2 is based on proposals and comments by the Environmental Water Caucus and other environmental interests. And then Alternative 3 is based on letters and comments from communities and interests in the Delta. And, of course, it's our job under CEQA to independently determine the proper range of reasonable alternatives under CEQA. And we, you know, took the information that we got and concluded that it did, that these alternatives met the test for a reasonable range to make sure that you have an adequate and informed comparison and basis for a decision. And the alternatives are analyzed in the same level of detail as the proposed project, even though that's not required by CEQA, but we promised we would do that, and we did it. And then the impacts of the alternatives, of course, are compared to those of the project. The alternatives that do less than the Delta plan to halt and reverse increasing environmental and flood risk deterioration in the Delta are treated as having greater impacts to those areas. So, I mean, the reason why you're here and we're all here is that there are the situation in a lot of these areas is getting worse. Flood risk is getting worse because Delta levees are deteriorating. You know, water supply reliability is going down. Ecosystem is going down. So the failure to halt those is an impact in and of themselves. And so that's the one of the bases for how we compare the alternatives is, you know, depending on what you do about the problems is a basis for comparison. Okay, so to give you, like I said, we didn't want to get into the actual, and we'll do this, you know, at the next meeting, the meeting after that, but to give you a very, very high-level sense of kind of what the EIR is telling us at the highest level, I'm going to tell you a little story that hopefully will illustrate kind of what it tells us. So back in May, kind of at the end of the last rainstorm that happened at least up here in Sacramento, you know, I went out in my backyard and on a Friday after work and kind of went back there and looked at it, and I thought, you know, my yard's need some work. Half of it has got weeds growing up and they're getting taller and there's standing water and mosquitoes are infesting and, you know, some of my tile or walk paths were cracking and it was in bad shape. And then a part of my yard was okay, you know, looked all right. It had some plants that maybe I wanted to change out. Said, you know, this needs some help. So I said, all right, I'm gonna spend the weekend doing this. So Saturday morning I get up and I spend all weekend in the yard. You know, I'm out in the part of the yard that really needed a lot of help and I'm pulling weeds and moving cracked stuff and getting rid of my old bird bath that had mosquitoes flying out of it. And, you know, and then in the yard, part of the yard that looked, you know, okay, but I wanted to swap out some of the plants. I'm like, I'm going to go to the nursery and I'm going to swap out some plants. And then Sunday at the end of the day, you know, I'm bruised and cut and I got sore muscles and I've got scrapes and blood from the rose bushes. And I standing on my back porch and I turn and I look at the yard. And I'm like, really? Like, for all of that, this is what I got. I'm like, you know what, it's late. I got to go to work tomorrow. So I go inside, and I shower, and I clean up, and I get the dirt from under my fingernails, and I put some salve on my cuts and the like, and then I go to work Monday morning. I get hit with this project that basically eats the rest of my, you know, month, six-week period of time. I just sort of didn't even look at my backyard again. You know, within a couple of days, I felt better, and my cuts had healed. And then 6 weeks, the project's over, and I come home on a Friday night, and, you know, I've been sunny for a month and a half, and I finally come in and I hadn't looked in my backyard in a month and a half, and I go to my backyard and I look, I'm like, wow. Okay, so those plants that a month ago that were still had the little tags hanging off them, now there's actually some stuff blooming on them. I see some color, and there's no more mosquitoes, and the weeds are gone, and the grass is starting to come up, and it, you know, it looks all right. And then I looked over the part of the yard where I had was okay, and we sort of swapped out some plants, and I said, well, all right, I guess maybe that's an improvement. You know, I kind of liked what I had before, but those new ones are okay. And that's kind of what we realize with this EIR is to get some benefit in your backyard, there's going to be some short-term pain to get there. Doing a new levee in the Delta is going to require a lot of construction work, and those construction work has impacts. It has construction impacts. It has could have water quality impacts in the near term, but those are short-term, generally short-term impacts that are real. They're not fake. And it's going to take short-term, like I said, you know, it's projects to achieve the short-term goals or co-equal goals are non-environmentally free of charge. It's in the short term, there's going to be a lot of impacts, and the EIR will call those out. And a lot of the resource sections are construction-focused, ground disturbance kind of things, you know, digging up historic cultural resources and paleontological resources. I mean, once the construction's over, that's done, but they're real potential impacts. So that's one thing that EIR kind of tells us, is that it's going to take some short-term pain to get to achieve the co-equal goals. And the other piece is that even the long-term trade-out, swapping the plant that you like for another plant, it's not free either. You know, building a new desalination plant on the Southern California coast may get you some more water supply reliability, but it could, you know, there's some ecosystem issues on the coast, visual impacts and the like. It's not free, and it's important that the EIR discloses that those are trade-offs. You know, building a new ecosystem restoration project in the Delta requires loss of agricultural land, and CEQA recognizes agricultural land as a environmental resource. Building a new reservoir up in the Sierra foothills might get you some more water supply reliability, but it could come at the cost of biological and other resources that are in the canyons, or in the case of, you know, Tulare Lake, to bring out one. I mean, that's there's agriculture going on there. So that's the other thing, is that in the part of your yard where it might be okay, you know, there's a trade-off, and not in every case, but in many cases. And then, you know, there's short-term cost to get to long-term reduction in other impacts. So the value of the EIR, again, it informs the council and the public of these trade-offs, long-term and short-term versus long-term trade-offs. And importantly, it'll guide and inform other agencies who are going to be, you know, who you hopefully will be implementing the projects that you want them to implement to achieve the co-equal goals. It'll identify for them some of the potential impacts. It'll lay out mitigation strategies that they could consider when they're doing their, you know, project-specific documents. So the next steps for the EIR, we've kind of been through these. January, we'll review the comments and develop written responses. February or March, we'll develop the actual written responses and issue them in a final EIR. And then March, there'll be a conclusion about the final EIR, and or April, depending on how the schedule lines up. It'll probably be in March. And then you will consider and possibly certify the EIR if you so choose. And that's it.
That concludes your presentation.
Yeah.
Any questions of council members? Any further questions? Hank?
James, when you said the council certifies EIR, what does that mean?
It means certifying that it complies with CEQA. Because the whole purpose of CEQA is to allow informed decision making. So it is an informational document, and so you are not approving it, so to speak. You are just certifying that it complies with the law as a piece of information, as an important piece of information for you then subsequently to make your informed decision about which Delta plan or which ultimate compilation of the Delta plan that you want to adopt.
Are we judging the the accuracy of it?
You're judging that it complies with the requirements of CEQA. You're exercising your independent judgment about it, and it's a legal requirement before you can use it to take an action that you certify that, in your best judgment, it complies with the requirements of CEQA.
And isn't I think I know this, but I want to be sure I know it. The standard's not perfection. The standard is adequacy for a reasonable adequacy for a set of reasonable decision makers to rely on in making important decisions.
Yeah, and there's
is legions. There another word I'm missing in there?
No, that captures it pretty well. I mean, there's legions of case law about that the standard is not perfection, that it's that I think that's the best way. Yeah, it doesn't demand perfection. It doesn't demand doing every single study that somebody may want. There are limits. The purpose of it is to ensure that you are adequately informed, and minor little items that, you know, don't really change the information at the end of the day kind of fall below the line. But it's, you know, this is our Bible. As you can see, it's marked up, and Ellen has hers here, and it's marked up, and you know, this is CEQA. I mean, it's a long statute, and with guidelines and a couple hundred cases. So it's a very.
I just wanted to say that the word reasonable is threaded throughout CEQA and throughout the guidelines, and the requirements are that the EIR disclose all that it reasonably can, and should be based on substantial evidence, even if there's other evidence that conflicts. If the evidence it relies on is substantial evidence, that's sufficient.
Comments, questions? Then, Joe, early on in this conversation, the questions came up about scheduling and meetings and so on. Have you had a chance to mull that over? It seems to me that there was a question about the time devoted at the November and December meetings for oral comments. There was a question whether additional meetings or workshops should be scheduled. There was a question about possibility of field hearings, and then there was also a question about the length of the comment period, 45, 60, or more. Any thoughts about all that?
We'll walk through those. And obviously, this is these are council decisions, but I'll tell you what my thoughts are after hearing the discussion. I kind of like the idea of going out to the regions and having a one-day combined session on, and I'd say three areas. I'd say Northern California, north part of the state, Central Valley, and Southern California. And so we have half the day that talks about what the Delta plan is, about the policies and recommendations that are in it, a couple hours explaining what the EIR is, and then we have 3 or 4 hours of comment, of formal hearings on comments. And so we do that in each of those three areas. And to be honest, I'm not sure that we need more time here if we do that there.
Let's push pause at that point and get council reaction to that suggestion.
Well, Joe, when you say Southern California, are you talking Los Angeles or San Diego?
How about Orange County? So we do it in between.
Irvine, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. You know, we have to figure out where we can get the right venue and organize it. It's not something I can say for sure right now, but I think there are venues that we could do, and our attorneys are going to tell me what I'm doing is wrong. So we'll say this and then be informed by what our attorneys have to say. Yeah. But, yeah, my sense is we could find a place that is reasonably accessible for all of urban Southern California.
Well, that would be reasonably inaccessible to most of urban Southern California.
I'm perfectly willing to do, too.
We can talk about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I understand that it's going to be difficult to develop a plan as we
absolutely
sit here today,
and understand that we have to notice this across the state to everybody. This is not something we have noticed it. So,
yeah, I was just going to recommend, obviously, it's your decision. I believe the notice has been printed with the two dates that Jim talked about. So maybe an idea would be to supplement that according to what you guys are talking about. And that's, I think, a good idea. Right. I think so, but just to let you know, in order to meet all the scheduling and the noticing to get out to newspapers, we actually did have to go to print yesterday with the notice that has the November and December dates and times. So
that same is true for the extension of the timeline. So if we're going to extend the comment period, we will also need to notice that. So it would be good if there's conceptual agreement about that concept, we can figure out how to do that over the next week or so and develop that schedule. And then we need to talk about the extension of the timeline, because if we're going to do another notice, I'd want to include that at the same time. Am I accurate there, Jim?
What I would suggest is, you know, because we have a 60-day comment period, and because you know, I think to allow people to have some time with the document before they, you know, come in and comment, what I would suggest is that staff come up with a plan, and you get to investigate places and where you could have them and availability and the like, and come up with that plan for additional hearings to happen in probably early December is probably when they would have to happen, and then come back with that plan at the November 17th meeting, and then we could go out shortly thereafter with press releases and other types of notices for hearings of, you know, a few more scattered about in maybe the first half of December would be my suggestion.
Seems like a good suggestion. What's the council? How does the council feel about that? Don?
Mr. Chair, I do think, though, this kind of hinges a bit on if we were to extend the period to 90 days, because, again, recognizing everybody's schedules, not just the folks that are going to be conducting the hearings, but folks that you would be reaching out to, maybe early December works, but if you were to take the 90-day approach, it would give you the ability then to maybe, you know, break that over the holiday period and not push up too close against the holiday period, and still allow time for receiving comments, do the workshops, and so forth. And I think that the point you make, Jim, I mean, it's part of that's not lost on me, that, you know, we're going to be back in here basically 2 weeks after the release of a document, and the expectation that not only folks could, you know, pile through that or get to the portions they feel are important, then, you know, get their comments, and they'll have time to do that in writing, I recognize. But I think from the standpoint of the verbal input, and I think the information, as Felicia said earlier, that it comes from doing the workshop and actually talking about the Delta plan and the EIR, and then, you know, properly framing that and then allowing for public comment of, you know, whatever nature, it seems to me that, you know, we're going to put a lot of pressure on everybody to have to do this early December, which, you know, that may sound like a long ways away now, but, you know, that'll be here before we know it. I guess I just would suggest we might want to talk about that, you know, the 90-day window for comments, and maybe get, you know, allow folks some time to think about, you know, where, when we'd make these workshops available to folks. So,
Hank?
Well, again, I applaud Joe's comment to talk about the plan as well. I think it's a great opportunity. I would advocate doing one meeting one day in Los Angeles and another day in San Diego. And ultimately, the voters are going to have to approve this, and they have to understand it, and it gives them an opportunity to query people, to raise objections, questions, and all the rest of that. And I think it'll give us some pretty good feedback.
So the staff attorney recommendation at this point is that we've published the notice for two meetings, November 17th and December, whatever day that was, for 3.5 hours each day, and we've published a 60-day comment period. It would come back on November 17th, review that, and adjust it, and we're asking staff to make recommendations based on what you've heard to adjust that. Is that satisfactory for everyone?
Can we have further discussion about the 90-day comment period? I'd seen something from the attorneys about our ability to do that. You guys want to comment on that?
The CEQA, this gets at Phil's custom comment, law and custom. The guideline says the public review period for a draft EIR shall not be less than 30 days nor longer than 60 days except in unusual circumstances. And when it's a big state document, it's a minimum of 45 days. But it says, you know, nor longer than 60 days except in unusual circumstances. That's the guidance. It's not a hard and fast rule. Just to give you a frame of reference, the high-speed rail EIRs, and I worked on those, so that's why they're familiar to me, which in many regards it were much more technically, because they were project-level EIRs on a massive project, where there's a lot more technical information, lots and lots more technical information. Conceptually, it wasn't as complicated as this one, because it was just, you know, you knew where the tracks were going to be. That was a 60-day comment period. But there's no hard and fast rule. And I think also recognizing at the back end that we're going to get a lot of comments on the Delta Plan EIR, which is great. I mean, that's what the process is about. But that we have to respond in writing to each one of those. And that's going to take time. I mean, it can take, depending on the volume, it can take 2 weeks to a month and a half just to compile them and to understand them, to even start responding. And then you have to start drafting. So by extending the comment period by 30 days, if you don't extend the adoption period by 30 days, then you're creating a more difficult process than it was otherwise to be difficult. So just recognize that part.
Yeah, I was just going to fully agree with that comment that we need to recognize that. And also, as our chair reminds us, that we do have a statutory deadline to adopt the plan by January 1st. Obviously, that's going to slip by a few months. There's another date in the statute that we have to keep in mind, too. We are required to report to the legislature on or before March 31st of 2012 as to the adoption of the Delta plan. So it's just another check-in period that I want to make sure is, you know, right.
This may be the minority opinion, but I think 60 days is adequate. I'm more concerned about the turnaround time for staff. I think that's where you can't rush that. All the comments have to be considered and processed and put together in a fashion that can be communicated to the council for our review. So I know that in most cases, there's going to be a lot of professionals working on the comments, and that we're not going to get 10,000 different comments. We're probably going to get 500 of many similar types of comments. So I guess at this point we can wait until November 17th to make the call on whether it's a 60 or more day public comment period.
I also think once the document is out and it is available and people see it, and then we, you know, present as to what it contains, you know, that may inform the necessity for, or the adequacy of 60 days or necessity for 90.
Yeah, I'm in the 60-day camp, too. Just people got to focus, just like we have to focus. And I don't think someone's going to spend 3 months solid working on it. It's a question of booking the time.
All right, anything else for the panel? Thank you very much. And again, good work. The final item on our agenda is public comment period. I see we have some blue slips that have been turned in. First up, David Nesmith. There's a button at the base of the...
Thanks. Dave Nesmith, facilitator for the California Environmental Water Caucus. We've, as you know, been following this process very closely and attach great importance to the Delta Plan and the Delta Planning process, and I'm very glad that you are on the council. It's a good council and a good staff to have working on this. The comments I'm going to make are brief, and they are all summaries of the document that we submitted to you a few weeks ago, where we had extensive comments and well footnoted, and we consider them all to be important. But I want to emphasize a couple of things that are really, I think, deserve to be emphasized on the in the process of developing this plan. There's a great deal of need for specificity in several parts of this planning process. If your process simply identifies the status quo and continues the Delta in the current trajectory, I think we will not have expended the kind of talent and time that is being expended here in a good way, in a useful way. Let me be specific. With regard to public trust, it's really important for the Delta Plan to be as specific as possible and as clear as possible on the public trust. For instance, definitions. You need to define for yourselves and for us what is a reliable water supply. What does it mean to protect, restore, and enhance the Delta ecosystem? And exactly what actions are necessary for enhancement of Delta as a place? And what does regional self-reliance look like? And what does the reduced dependence on the Delta look like? If Phil were here, he would remind us all that the Bay Area, from which I come, is as much or perhaps more reliant on the Delta, if you include diversions upstream, as other parts of the state that that do use Delta water. And basically, my opinion is that the Bay Area has not gotten the memo. They don't understand how reliant they are on the Delta. Since LA and other parts south have to pump out the Delta water all the way up the hill and up over the hill, they're much more motivated, I think, economically to find ways to reduce dependence on the Delta. This needs to be redefined so that we have other tools to get the Bay Area and the rest of the state onto the next step for reducing reliance. There is a glaring lack of economic analysis of public trust values. And you know, this is something that's economists have done this now for the last 20 years. They have worked to attach an economic value to externalized impacts, to things that aren't normally considered economically measurable. The economics of recreational and commercial fisheries is, there are several good studies in California on the economics of commercial and recreational fisheries. What are the impacts of a Delta plan of the proposed actions on recreational and commercial fisheries? We ought to be able to do that. water quality impacts. What are the impacts of the existing water quality, and what would be the impacts of a continued trajectory, whether that be in any particular water quality parameter, a downhill trajectory or an uphill trajectory? What would happen to the deltas, to the beneficial uses of the delta and the beneficial uses, including fisheries and aquatic life, of water quality degradation or improvement? We ought to be able to get some kind of ballpark on that one. Goals and objectives and performance measures need to be science-based. And the governance is utterly key. And you all know this. It's a tar baby. It's really a hard one to figure out how to do governance in a way that is open, transparent, representative, and can actually do the job, because there are so many interests in the Delta, and all of you have been around the block on this one as well as we have, and it's a tough one, but it has to be tackled. With regard to the to governance, the on page 54, line 27, we recommend changing the word promote to meet, this is the sentence. The council may incorporate other completed plans related to the Delta into the Delta plan to the extent that the other plans meet the co-equal goals rather than promote co-equal goals. Stronger language. And I think that promotion is a nice thing, but meeting it would be a much more specific and useful. And finally, with regard to water supply, we all know that federal and state contracts for water are in most years not able to be met. And in fact, the State Water Project does not have half of the potential water supply because our governor, in his previous governorship, took several North Coast rivers into the Wild and Scenic River system, so that the State Water Project contracts, which were written prior to that, cannot be met. And it would be, I know that this is not in your purview directly, but to have in the Delta Plan a recognition that federal and state contracts cannot be fully met most years, and that water supply reliability has to be defined some way other than full contracts in normal and wet years. Because even in normal years, it's way over-appropriated. And the water supply reliability really needs to be linked clearly in the plan to recovery milestones and recovery specific milestones and goals. For instance, if the salmon are halfway to the anadromous fish restoration goals, recommendations in the CVPIA, then we could allow a certain amount of diversions, of export diversions. And I know that Delta exports is only a fraction of the diversions that the Delta is suffering from. But they are the ones that are the most junior in most cases, the South Delta diversions. So that somehow linking water supply and specific ecological goals is utterly key, and it needs to be specific so that we can actually set milestones meet those milestones, and the agency that makes the decision on whether those milestones have been met probably should not be the water contractors or the water sellers, because their interests perhaps might be inimical to the judgment necessary to do this well. So those are my suggestions. I thank you for very, very much for your work.
Thank you for your comments. Pete Koutras, next. You can stand at the mic if you prefer.
Is this on?
It will be when you push the button.
This button?
That's it.
All right, thank you. Technology. I have to express a little bit of chagrin having your general counsel and this panel being dismissed before public comment, because we have some significant concerns over the timeline, the public comment period, and some others, and I wanted to be able to, for them to hear that. But I will put it on the record here, ask them to watch the video, I guess. First off, the documents that was presented by your consultant and put on the overhead are not available out here. I would appreciate if they would be posted so we can see them. Second, you're at the very, very end of a long process, and I'm going to caution you not to rush. You've done a lot of work about public transparency. You've done a lot of work about involving stakeholders. Don't rush this last process. There's a lot of discussion here about the staff turnaround and the time your staff has to do the work once they receive comments. But I want you for a minute to walk a mile in our shoes, the reclamation districts, the cities, the counties, the Delta residents. You're asking them to jam over a holiday period, which you've already described as a complex, never before done EIR, and get comments back within 60 days, and a 2,000-page, 100-year horizon plan. It's unprecedented, and I would submit to you that you do fall under the CEQA longer than 60 days, and I would ask you today to direct your staff to either put a public comment period of either 90 or 120 days, realizing, yes, you will have to move your implementation date. But I think, you know, we all expected this EIR September, October. Now it's early November. That's fine. It's complex. It takes time. I'm not carping about that. What I am is asking you to not push us. We don't have the resources. This council has spent somewhere between $5 to $10 million and staff and consultant resources to produce this. We don't have that kind of resource to jam over a 60-day period to make comments. The other salient point is we've been told consistently through the process, don't worry, we will have to respond to your comments during the EIR phase, because we've all asked you over the months and the last year or so, hey, we've given you comments on draft X, we haven't heard what happened to our comments. And we've been told consistently, don't worry, when we get to EIR stage, we will have to provide comment to anything that you give us. This is our opportunity to do that, and we want to make sure that we use it judiciously. I do like the idea, whenever you do them, of having additional public comment meeting time. I would caution you not to do workshops. Again, the concern is, the workshop on EIR, we aren't guaranteed that you have to respond to those comments. So that's, again, a concern that you do time. Different point on the suggestion of additional workshops on governance or covered action. Obviously, we support that. We think those are valuable and useful. And lastly, in terms of moving around, potentially you might consider at the point you're adopting the plan that you have a roadshow period where you go out on the road for 30 days in various parts of the state and say, hey, this is what we've adopted. We want you to know what's in it. We want you to know what we've sent to the legislature. That's something that might be very helpful. But again, the main point here, we're looking for a 90 to 120-day public comment period. We're looking for public comment meeting time, and we do think this is an extraordinary situation. So thank you.
Bert Wilson next.
Does red light mean it's on?
That's affirmative.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to comment that the health of the salmon, improved health of the salmon in the Delta, is not due to science, but due to federal regulations which have decreased water diversions. I want to make that point. 2 days ago, I was in a meeting of the Bay Delta Conveyance Plan, and they presented some new scientists which were going to do an effects analysis on the Delta. Now, is this going to be included in the environmental impact report, what they do? Does one hand know what the other one's doing? Because none of them were aware of a no conveyance alternative. So how are they going to do an effects analysis if there's no awareness of a no conveyance alternative? No answer.
Well, okay. I think they clearly know that they are required under law to do that as part of their environmental impact report.
Okay. All right, because I'm willing to bet a no conveyance alternative is going to come out on top in any EIR report. As we speak here, five Congress people are talking to the Interior Department about saltwater intrusion into the Delta. This is something that I've been talking about for 2 years. For 2 years, I've tried to get from the DWR the flow criteria of the estuary past Chips Island or Antioch. I have not been able to get that. The only thing I get is from a DSC chart, which shows that the minimum flow, given the five intakes on the Sacramento River, the minimum flow would be 3,500 cubic feet per second, which to me is a trickle pass there, which would allow saltwater intrusion into the Delta. And this is what the five Congress people are talking about here. Because if that's going to happen, I talked to Jerry Merrill about it, and he said, well, there isn't enough water in storage to prevent that. It's not a storage problem. It's a diversion problem. How much water can you divert without allowing saltwater intrusion at that point? I know that on the books already are water barriers which could be put in there, and they have plans for that. But you see, if they put those in, you're going to have to reinforce all the levees on the other side of the barriers 5 feet higher to keep them from overspilling. And this is going to ruin the Suisun Marsh also. So I'd like to get some answers here. I'd like to get the flow criteria past Chips Island or, what it takes, because that is going to be the criteria which is going to limit, in some way, the water diversions from the five intakes on the Sacramento River. And I don't think that this should be some nebulous thing that isn't answered beforehand, and I hope the five Congress people are getting answers also. I have admired your stance on transparency, yet we've uncovered the fact now that there have been private meetings of water contractors south of the Delta in which water contractors north of the Delta have not been invited to, and they're making separate deals for that. I hope the five congresspeople will get to the bottom of that, because that's really important. Another thing is, as I heard today, the EIR will not evaluate projects when specifics are not known. Now, boy, is that an open invitation do we have specifics on what a 1,400-foot wide cement ditch is going to do to the Delta, or a 33-inch, 300-foot deep tunnel where we have a subduction zone under the Delta? Well, what's that's going to do? Are those specifics? Is this going to allow, what I'm afraid of, is this is going to allow things to get into the plan simply because the specifics are not known. And I'd like to see that prevented some way. I think that's your charge. I think, you know, if somebody could get me or publish on a website the flow data past Chips Island, what it takes to prevent salinity from coming in, golly, you know, you'd be doing a great public service. Thank you for your attention.
Bert, thank you. Greg Zlotnick is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and council members. Greg Zlotnick with State and Federal Contractors. I think we need to mark the time, because I'm going to agree with Mr. Koutras on a lot of what he had to say. This is actually comments on item 9 as well, and so hopefully Chris and Joe might be able to answer some of the questions. In terms of the public comment period, I think we would probably say, I think the issue of holidays is legitimate, and perhaps 75 days, you know, add another 15, so you go 75 to 90 in that range, but at least that sort of covers the holiday period a little bit and doesn't take you out too far. Questions about the presentation, and I know it's late and there's not a lot you can do with the document, obviously, in the next week, but it's sort of trying to get a flavor of how these issues might be dealt with or some things to think about. First of all, on the slide, it talked about there were five project categories that were going to be looked at. I think it was five. And the question is, will the document analyze those, because there's cross benefits? You know, a water supply project will have benefits to the ecosystem, to the Delta's place, et cetera. A levee, you know, all that. So the question for them was, are you dealing with those issues in terms of cross benefits rather than siloing these things, which has been a problem, and how that gets dealt with. Another thing is on the no action alternative. Because of this sort of unique situation where we're dealing with a plan and not a project, does it just talk about no action? I think the gentleman talked about, well, no action is sort of what other projects will be taking place anyway, sort of. Well, what about the no action? There was an impetus to do the Delta plan. There are things that are going to happen in the Delta and with the state if we don't address these issues. Is that going to be part of the discussion of the no action alternative or not? We think it should be. How does BDCP going to be get dealt with? We know that it's not definitively in the plan unless it satisfies the criteria, the statute, and the appeal, all that stuff. But I think earlier on when we talked about this, it's sort of, well, we kind of have to deal with it and without it, in essence, in the analysis. And sort of related to that is BDCP deals with projects itself within pretty much all of those categories that you had up there. And one of the difficulties is that we would be concerned about is that in the analysis of it would be a without BDCP analysis, as you start picking projects out that may or may not happen, when BDCP, by definition, assuming it satisfies the NCCP and HCCP requirements, is itself going to be a net benefit to the environment. I mean, that's required. So, you know, if you start pulling things out of what comprise BDCP, you sort of lose that, and who knows how that all gets dealt with. Very complicated, I understand that, but there's a real sensitivity, of course, on how that gets dealt with in the analysis. And then lastly, we've heard today, I assume we'll get that calendar will be distributed and we'll see the schedule for the EIR, but as we've talked about, the Delta plan development is separate from the EIR. It's not the same thing. And so we haven't heard any schedule on the Delta Plan development. And the Delta Plan comments, while there's some technical information, are primarily policy and not technical. Whereas the EIR is the other way around, as you've described, the point is technical. And so in terms of this notion of response to comments that Pete raised on the Delta Plan, that's sort of a different set of response to comments that really don't involve responding to comments in the EIR, because those are going to be more policy-oriented in all likelihood. So anyway, all of that, how does that all fit in? And
Greg, Joe touched on that earlier, but why don't you review that one more time?
I'll clarify, because I thought I was trying to be clear. Right now, we are working on a document that goes through and analyzes, here are all the comments, mm-hmm. and here's what we've done with the comments. We're going to try
on the Delta Plan.
On the Delta Plan.
Okay.
Our plan has been that we wait till the end of the EIR period, but at that January meeting, we actually come in with a report that says, this is what the comments were, here's what we've done in the past, here are the new comments, here's what we recommend, here are issues that council you should pay attention to and give us direction on. Okay. So that we can develop a sixth draft for the February meeting, okay. which can lead to a seventh draft for the March meeting, which hopefully is close to final, and they can make final changes and adopt it, assuming that we've got that, you know, that we've paid attention to what the
sure.
EIR does. You
okay.
have to do the EIR certification and make sure you've addressed all of those comments.
Right. So it sounds like the if you will, the policy responses will
January.
Be in a separate document.
It will be a separate document,
okay.
yes.
And then also I assume the calendar will show both schedules for the moving the Delta Plan
yeah.
forward.
The only
whatever.
Calendar we had today was council meetings. We didn't have a more detailed calendar.
No, I know, but even the meetings where you're going to talk about it and stuff, that's always useful for us to plan as well. I mean, we don't want to miss these
for
things.
For us, too. We want to make sure we just don't have it yet.
Right. Thanks.
Greg, thank you. Tom Zuckerman.
Thank you. I am Tom Zuckerman, representing the Central Delta Water Agency. And I really largely want to support what Mr. Kutra said, but I have, you know, I've tried to follow this process. I've tried to envision how you would do an environmental document based upon what has really evolved into a series of policies and recommendations. And what I heard today makes it sound like you're going to have a very, very unusual EIS, because it's you're really apparently assuming that people are going to pay attention to what these policies and recommendations are, and then you're making some assumptions about how they might respond to them, and then what the pluses and minuses from a CEQA point of view would be as a result of that. And I've never seen that kind of a document before. And I understand it's going to be lengthy. I'd like you to be sympathetic to the fact that we're not in a vacuum here. There's a lot of other issues going on simultaneously. I'm several hundred pages behind in reading things that have come out within the last few days and anticipate a lot more happening during this 60-day period you're talking about. I think 60-day comment period is completely unrealistic under these circumstances. Once you've breached the levy of your time restrictions that you've been trying to adhere to all along, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't be providing a sufficient amount of time and a liberal amount of time for the public to respond to this at the end. Hope you will think positively about doing so. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And the last request I have is from Pete Campa.
Pete Campa, General Manager, Tuolumne Utilities District. And I again want to echo my agreement with the prior commenters with regard to any additional meetings you can provide, informational meetings, any additional extension of the comment period would be much appreciated. You know, I do, and we do dedicate the time to these types of projects, but, you know, we have, as a small agency, We have just so much financial resources to hire outside consultants and just so much internal resources to dedicate to such an important process. So very important to us to have as much time as possible understanding your schedule. The other thing that I do want to also echo is my concern that we lost the panel. That was really the extent of my comments were they made some substantial statements in a bullet point. And it means a lot to us that spent hundreds of hours on the Ag Urban Coalition developing alternatives, and they listed the fact that those alternatives were being considered. Then the very next slide went on to say that those alternatives that were considered to do less were going to have more impact. Well, what does do less mean? Because that's a very important point. One person's idea of what addresses a problem better is going to be different than someone else's potentially. So I just wanted clarity from them, and I'm sure in our review we'll discover what they really meant behind that statement. So I just wanted to raise that point and had hoped to get comments from them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Pete. Mark Renz.
Mark Renz, Association of California Water Agencies. Thank you very much. I appreciate a lot of the input that's been made so far. Just to reiterate a couple comments, I think many of the suggestions that Ms. Marcus floated out there about involving and reaching out to the public are critical. We encourage you to consider those strongly. It sounds like you have. That was part of my comment. Also would like to get a copy, and I'm sure we will, because a couple comments I'm going to make here refer to points that your counsel, the general Attorney General's counsel, made in his presentation, and I wish I had a copy in front of me, but I think I took pretty good notes. Here's the question I have and why I think it's important to continue to educate the public. I got two points here that I'm trying to figure out how they play within each other, and perhaps somebody can clarify for me. Obviously, your counsel's gone, so he can't. Thank you, Randy, and I'll try and find it on the slides here. But one point that he said is, if you'll bear with me, on the approach to the EIR analysis, he says, the EIR does not evaluate whether the project or the alternatives will meet the co-equal goals. And then another point in there, the very next slide, as a matter of fact, approach to the EIR analysis says the EIR assumes the Delta plan will be successful. Well, in my mind, and maybe I'm just missing something here, I'm trying to conclude what constitutes successful. And I'd like an answer to that question. So we, as we prepare to comment, I think to me that is a paramount question. And we've raised that question time and time again. How does this council define success? And so I'm trying to put in my mind is if the EIR doesn't evaluate whether the project, which is the staff's fifth iteration of the Delta plan, if that project or the alternatives, you're not going to evaluate whether it meets co-equal goals, but you're going to assume the Delta plan will be successful. What is success? We need to understand that. The two bullets under that says, as I got it here in my notes, the Delta plan proposes policy and recommendations that encourage the other agencies to undertake new projects. So does that constitute success just because you propose policy and recommendations, or is it because the actual new projects come into play? The EIR assumes these types of projects will occur. There's assumptions built upon assumptions as I'm reading these slides. Now, again, I haven't had the chance to spend the time like your staff, and I look forward to looking, and thank you for providing it. But I sure hope the council has an understanding of the relationship between the fact that the EIR does not evaluate whether the project or alternatives will meet the co-equal goals and what the council understands to be constitute success. And that's the only comment I wanted to bring forward today. And I hope you'll have that deliberation amongst yourself at some point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Mark, before you leave, I think that's an important point, and Joe can chime in here as well. I think the presentation that from which you were reading was accurate, but let's just talk about what this document actually is that's about to hit the street. It's a draft environmental impact report, and as I think Jim or Ellen eloquently stated, CEQA requires you to study the environmental impacts of your proposed project, which we all know is the Delta Plan, at least the fifth staff draft of the Delta Plan, and a reasonable range of alternatives, and that's what it's going to do. The point that Jim was raising was that in this draft that's going to hit the streets, right, on Friday, it is not going to address, but we will later address, before we adopt the final Delta Plan, whether or not the alternatives meet what we call the project objectives. The project objective is the key. It's achieving the co-equal goals and the inherent objectives and other things that you'll see once the document comes out. So there will be a definition of what the project objective is, and then in the draft, you'll see the environmental impacts of the proposed project, the reasonable range of alternatives, and at a later date, we will have an analysis and assessment of the alternatives as against the proposed project, measured up against the project objectives, which does it meet the co-equal goals? Does it meet the state law requirements? So you will see that in the end, and this council will see that in the end before it makes a final decision. So your point is a good point, and I'm glad that you gave us the opportunity to clarify that. Joe may want to add.
Well, I want to add, I think what he was talking about when he says they assume success, when they were, and this is how they explained it to me, when they explained what they were doing. In order to have a conservative document that actually says what are the worst impacts or what are the most impacts that could occur, they needed to look at each of our recommendations, and so not just policies but recommendations, and assume that those recommendations were carried out, and what would be the impact if those recommendations were carried out of that occurring. So that made it a complex process, because for example, we recommended increased storage. We recommended a number of things in the plan, and so they assumed that those would be implemented, and then tried to look at what would be the impacts if the recommendations in the draft plan were implemented, and all of the other alternatives too. So that meant that it was more complex than I ever imagined, and I'm not sure, I want to say this, even though it may be controversial, I'm not sure, honestly, that our law that requires us to do an environmental impact report in this way truly serves the public purpose all the time of informing decision makers and informing the public of the consequences. So some cases, the law requires things that I think are convoluted and make the document hard to understand. At least that's my perspective on seeing this. And I haven't read the whole document yet, by the way.
And I haven't been privileged to see the document yet.
You'll get it.
And I don't know if that's going to be a privilege, seeing as it's 2,000 plus pages.
So you understand what that successful, yeah. I think that's what he was trying to say.
Let me make sure I understand Chris's comment, if I could, Chris, because first of all, let me empathize with everybody, staff, council, the interested public. This is, in all my years of dealing with CEQA and NEPA, I've never seen anything like it, and I think you've heard that from many people who are even more involved in CEQA and NEPA than I have been, though I've had quite a bit of exposure to it. So I'm truly appreciative of that and kind of resting my comments on that. But, Chris, the elements you talked about, I'm assuming those will be present for the public to ponder over when that draft EIR comes out. This coming Friday?
The elements that I talked about were the
environmental,
the project objective will be in there. That will define what the project is. But the part that you're talking about and the part that you alluded to from Jim's presentation was the actual assessment,
right,
measuring up the alternatives as to whether or not they meet the project objective. Again, that's not going to be in the draft document, but it will be made available shortly thereafter. This council will have the benefit of that because it's very important before it makes its ultimate decision on whether or not to adopt and in what form to adopt the Delta Plan.
And we'll have that.
And you will have the benefit of seeing that as well.
With sufficient time to comment on that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, then I'll rest. I still will be intrigued to see how the EIR, when it comes out, does describe success, because I understand what you're saying, Joe, about the environmental impacts, but I'm looking at environmental impacts based on a lot of assumptions, which is very, very intriguing. We've all dealt with specific projects in the past, so there's layer of assumption upon layer of assumption upon layer of assumption, which makes it very challenging for all of us, and that's the main message I wanted to bring forward.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's the last of the public comment requests that I've received. Seeing there's no further, this meeting is adjourned. Our next meeting will be November 17th and 18th, a change of venue. It will be at the Sheraton Grand Hotel on J Street, November 17th and 18th. See you then, if not before.